Then I will come back to order. Messages from the House.
February the 7th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 161, Interstate Compact on Students of Military Families, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 190, Electronic Fine Submittal. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 202, Railroad Fence Repairs. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 203, Child Support Orders. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 223, Property Disclosure Statement, Wind Estate. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 249, Acceptance of Citation, ayes 51, noes 8, excused 1. And House Bill 174, Designated Transfer of State Lands, ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 7th, 2011, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 7, Wyoming Veterinary Medical Practice Acts 2, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 135, State Lands Improvements 2, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. House Bill 144, School District Bonds, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 151, Hydropower Development, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 193, Nursing Care Facility Assessment, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. House Bill 206, Emergency Response Incidents, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 209, Emergency Medical Review Organizations, ayes 58, excused 1. House Bill 215, Department of Health Reorganization, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 217, Production States Agreement, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 224, Platted Plots Requirement, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 254, Property Taxation Appeals, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 39, Health Litigation Fund, ayes 50, noes 9, excused 1. House Bill 211, County Memorial Hospital Board Members Removal, ayes 59, excused 1. And House Bill 230, Eminent Domain Wind Energy Collector Systems 2, ayes 53, no 6, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 190, first reading of the bill.
House Bill 190, Electronic Fine Submittal, an act relating to the courts, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer, passed the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 190 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 203, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 203, Child Support Orders, and Act Relating to Domestic Relations, sponsored by Representative Lubnow. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 203 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 249, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 249, Acceptance of Citation, an Act Relating to Criminal Procedure, sponsored by Representative Bob Nicholas, passed the House on third reading, ayes 58, noes 8, ayes 51, noes 8, excused 1.
House Bill 249 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 161, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 161, Interstate Compact on Students of Military Families, an Act Relating to Education, sponsored by Representative Illoway. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 161 has been assigned to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 174, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 174, Designated Transfer of State Land, and Act Relating to State Lands, sponsored by Representative McComey. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1.
House Bill 174 has been assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 202, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 202, Railroads, Fence Repairs, an Act Relating to Railroads, sponsored by Representative Brown. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 202 has been referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 223, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 223, Property Disclosure Statement, Wind Estates, an Act Relating to Property. Supplemented by Representative Brown. Pass the House on third reading, ayes 59, excused 1.
House Bill 223 has been assigned to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Reports from standing committees.
February the 7th, 2011, Mr. President, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 129, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business for consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. Senator Hines, would you like to return to the chair, please?
Committee of the Whole has come to order. We're back on Senate File 70. We have passed Standing Committee Amendment 1 and Standing Committee Amendment 2. There is a Committee of the Whole meeting with amendment. Would the reading clerk please read in that amendment?
Senate File 70, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. Delete the Senate Standing Committee Amendment.
Okay, Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 and ask for the body to bear with me just for a minute. We do have two big Committee of the Whole Amendments coming. We have to deal with one subject. That's required by our rules. So keep in mind, as we work these next two Committee of the Whole Amendments, if we would have had one amendment, it would have been huge. And they are interrelated. So with that, I would defer to Senator Rothfuss to explain Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1, has a couple of objectives which are consistent with what we were trying to do with the original Standing Committee amendment. I'll briefly go over the intent, and then we can go through the amendment. There's a few things that are going to be going on with this amendment. The first is that it's going to delete and replace the Standing Committee amendment with this Standing Committee amendment that we're talking about. Committee of the Whole amendment. So the first thing it's going to do will be delete the amendment that we previously passed. The second essential thing that it's going to do is restore a school-based accountability instead of a district-based. So we'll see that in language as we're moving through. The third and fourth points are really the keys. The third is that it's going to establish core indicators on the school-based scorecard, which will be based on elementary school-level performance at third, fourth, and fifth grade reading, based on the statewide assessment. And for secondary level performance, that will be measured in eighth grade on the college readiness test covering English, reading, math, and science, and the 11th grade college readiness test covering English, reading, math, and science. So the purpose of that, as we go through, you'll see, is these are already things that are being done. So we're identifying tests and measures that are already in place for the first year to set our performance baselines with. Previously, we were looking at creating new baselines, new performance standards, and what we're trying to do for the first year is simplify that in our phase one to make sure that we have things in place already and we don't have to promulgate a lot of rules and regulations to accomplish our first year baseline. The next thing that we're going to see as we move through the amendment is that we're going to target improvement levels or set target improvement levels for these core indicators. We'll see that there's a flawed system that is currently in the bill in its original incarnation. The Standing Committee amendment modified that to try and improve it, and what we're doing here is adding it back, but in a very simple form. And we'll discuss that form when we get there, but basically it's just a thumbs up or thumbs down. If the school improves between the first and second year or stays the same, that's going to be a thumbs up. If it doesn't, that's going to be a thumbs down. So it's not a very complicated system. The original form of the bill had a very complicated system that received an awful lot of complaint, Mr. Chairman, from our testimony. So we came up with a system that was fairly reliable and reasonable, that there couldn't be a lot of complaint to, but still gives us the ability to look at trend analysis as we move forward with the first phase moving into the second phase. Those are effectively the essential points. It also restores some consequences for failure and not meeting targets, both in the first year and then consequent years after that. And we'll talk about that as we move through the bill and look at the amendment. So on the amendment itself, amendments lines 1 through 4 on page 1 is simply to delete that Standing Committee amendment that we discussed. 5 and 6 talk about changing the current school standards to applicable. You can see that on page 2, line 17. We're looking at applicable schools accountability, basically, and that shall be, now going to the little one on line 19, it's talking about school level performance, and it will read in third, fourth, and fifth grade reading. Moving to the little two, that'll be struck, and it will instead read secondary school level outcomes. Now, those aren't defined right here, but they will be defined when we look at some paragraphs below, so we'll go to that in a moment. Little C continues to show school level performance in reading shall be measured by the statewide assessment system implemented. So obviously that's going back to things that are already in place. And then it goes on to discuss that a little bit. Now I'll note that lines 7 through 11 on page 3 are also going to be struck with this amendment. The reason for that is because we were talking about attaching labels with these performance indicators, which would include below basic, basic, proficient, and advanced. There was a lot of heartburn on that, particularly with the concepts of below basic and basic. So what we're looking at for our new indicators, we'll be changing that to whether you're on target for the performance or whether you're not on target, and we'll talk about that as we move a little bit forward in the amendment. Moving on to, if we're looking at page 3 of the bill, at the bottom, we're amending little Romanette 1 to read, for school-level reading in grades 3 through 5, use existing proficiency performance levels specified on the statewide assessment. So that's what we already discussed. We have those in place, and now we're looking at them for grades 3 through 5. Turning over to page 4 is a major amendment. Page 4 in the original bill is going to be struck. This was a weighting system, a criteria to generate an aggregate score that was probably the bulk of the criticism that we observed when we had testimony on Senate File 70. It truly is a flawed criteria. There were lots of case examples where this system would fail, and I believe that less than 10% of the schools in the state actually would have passed this assessment also was another bit of a criticism. So after looking at that, we have struck that. And you can see in our amendment, on page 1 of the amendment, where on page 3, lines 19 through 24, we delete and insert, you have new language here with a Romanet 1 that talks about for school-level reading in grades 3 through 5, use existing proficiency performance levels specified on the statewide assessment. And then it goes on, each school shall record year-to-year performance levels. Going on to the Roman 1 underneath, it describes what positive progress would be. It describes then what performance level unchanged would be and what negative progress would be. Again, this is comparing a year-to-year analysis. We set a baseline in the next school year. The following school year, using the same indicators, they'll measure whether that performance has improved or whether it has gone to negative progress, as we're calling it, which would indicate that there was some failure on the part of the school to actually move in the positive direction. You can see that the amendment continues to indicate point values, how those point values will be assigned on a school basis, and it's a very simple system, as you can see in Romans 1 through 3, that the schools demonstrating positive progress will get a positive point value, no change is a zero, and negative progress is going to be a negative point value. Again, we're looking for a very simple aggregating system that isn't going to lead to unintended consequences, but still gives us the ability to look at aggregate data throughout the school district and on a school-by-school basis. All right, looking at Romanet 2 now of the amendment that you see on line 21, page 2 of the Committee of the Whole Amendment. What this is it's looking at secondary school level outcomes. Now, you may recall on the previous page of the bill, we talked about the fact that we would have secondary school level outcomes described. And this describes in sub A and sub B how we will basically be using standardized curriculum-based college readiness tests, both in 8th grade and 11th grade, to evaluate English, reading, mathematics, and science to establish that readiness benchmark score for students. Again, these are things that are already statewide in place, so it's something that we felt we could go to for the first year as our baseline without having to have any major implementations, and we could get going, kind of hit the ground running instead of having to wait for new programs to be implemented. Looking at little 3 on line 36, page 2 of the amendment, all information generated under this paragraph shall be recorded by matrix format established by rule and regulation of the Department of Education. Basically, what that's saying is that the Department of Education will have to come up with a reporting system so that the school districts and the schools can report this back up through the system to the Department of Education for analysis, and hopefully that should be fairly straightforward. Now, you can see at this point when you're looking through the amendment, line 41, page 2, this is where we're actually deleting that fourth page, which is the previous scoring system, just for clarity. Moving on to page 2 of the amendment. Page 3 of the amendment. You can see that we're doing some cleanup language on page 5. And in particular, we're deleting lines 3 through 15 on page 5. Which again goes back to this concept we had before where we had an aggregate scoring system that developed an overall measurement for the school district that was based on that previous core criteria that we found to be flawed. As a result, we're striking this language, and the language that we previously specified covers that for the new system, where instead we're looking at proficient or negative performance. All right. Most of the rest is actually language. I believe all of the rest is language on this particular amendment that is going to be cleaning up the bill to maintain consistency with these points that we just discussed. So if we're changing the performance levels and we're changing the criteria, then we need some cleanup language throughout the rest of the bill to make sure that that's properly reflecting what we saw. The exception to that is probably moving on to page 22. So I'll go there right now. We're on the amendment. It's line 26 of page 3 of the amendment. We'll move to page 22 of the bill. And all this is some minor modifications to the task force that we're putting together. Excuse me, not a task force. I believe we're calling it a select committee, if I'm not mistaken. We've got a select committee and an advisory committee. The select committee is the legislative side, and the advisory committee are representatives from the education community that are going to work with the select committee as we move forward. As my colleague from Park County indicated, phase two is probably the essential part of this bill, where these two committees are going to work together to really figure out the path forward as we develop this accountability system. So there's some minor modifications to that, where we are adding a representative of the Wyoming business community appointed by the governor. That's an insertion after line 18 on page 22. And on page 22, line 4, excuse me for going backwards a little bit, but I skipped over it, we're deleting Education Association and adding State Board of Education, and what that's basically doing is labeling who the selection entity is going to be for the teachers that we're adding to this advisory committee. It will be the State Board of Education that's selecting those teachers. All right, now that was a pretty rapid approach to covering this, and hopefully that clarifies to some degree this first committee of the whole amendment. The second one, which will be moving shortly, will have other consequences that we can work back through. But the key here is to change the performance system, as I mentioned, so that we've got a measurement system in place for the first year. We're establishing core indicators based on the school scorecard that we talked about, which again is elementary school level performance in third, fourth, and fifth grade reading as measured by the statewide assessment. And then for secondary school, the performance is measured by those college readiness tests that are already in place. And then we discuss a method for analyzing the target improvement levels for those early years based on the tests that we already have in place. What it's essentially doing is changing the first few years of the phase one so that we have something in place that we can actually get done. And then phase two is further going to define the future, where we'll note in a little bit we're going to start looking at growth-based models and a lot of the other concepts that we've talked a lot for teacher accountability. So after that long explanation, Mr. Chairman, I'd certainly open it up for questions and any possible debate on this particular amendment, and would call for the question afterwards. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on questions on the amendment. Mr. Chairman, as I see the problems in designing any kind of accountability assessment system, I see two in particular. One is that you have quite a bit of variation in from one school to the next in terms of the quality of students that you get in. Some schools will have more students whose parents are better educated, whose parents care more, and see that the students work harder and work on it at home and therefore perform better. And some schools will have parents who don't. In my community, where we've got quite a bit of differentiation among the schools, where they've got a choice system, you've got some schools who have succeeded in absolutely insisting on parent involvement, otherwise the kid doesn't go to that school, and some other schools who have adopted a deliberate strategy of trying to attract and deal successfully with the students who have a great deal of difficulty and are having trouble learning. And one in particular wasn't actually in my district. It was in the next district, I think in Senator Perkins' district, where they were doing that and doing it pretty well. So you get, if you use an absolute measure of performance, it really isn't a good measure of how good a job the school is doing. because the incoming material is so different. And as I see this assessment system that the amendment is proposing, you deal with that by saying not what's the absolute level in the school, but are they getting better or are they getting worse? And so in that respect, this is a good amendment, Mr. Chairman. But then you get into another problem, and that is the school is the appropriate level at which to do these assessments, I think. But the numbers are so small because of the size of some of our schools, which I think leads to better education, but it gives you a problem here. You get random variation from one year to the next. And for reasons that have nothing to do with the quality of the education in the school, you will have relatively small, but they'll be there, declines in performance or improvements in performance. They really don't mean very much because it's a random variation in what kids happen to be in that year's particular class and how those kids perform. And my question is, okay, you've solved the problem of the incoming material. How do you deal with the problem of that random variation from one year to another, whereas I think a school that, like some of ours, show very well, could show some declines from one year to the next, and it looks like in this system they get dinged for that, even though it's essentially random variation on a good performance.
Senator Von Vleteren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question, standing up and in support of this particular amendment, I think you did a great cleanup on this bill. But on page 2 of the amendment, lines 24 through 28, is that an existing test they do give, or that I know it's a readily available test, and we don't want to name any particular provider by name, but is it something they give, or is that something we're going to add to their other testing?
Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And along those same lines, over on page 1, line 38, is that the existing PAWS test, or is that another test that we're going to find out about?
Senator Netting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at page 5. It seems like by eliminating all of that section, lines 3 through 15, that we are weakening the fact that this is a growth model, because we're taking out then the criteria that it is 2 points above the prior year for the combined school score. So I don't see that we have really retained a growth model after we eliminate this.
Senator Ruthless.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good time to stand up with 5 questions ready here. With regard to my good friend from Natrona County's questions regarding the variation of the parents, the nature of the children, and the concept of random variation over the years, I would say that's an excellent introduction to the Second Amendment, where we really look at tying the individual to the specific growth throughout the system and look at exactly those factors. So that's something that will certainly be considered, and it's an excellent point. Thank you. With regard to my colleague from Campbell County's considerations about the specific reference to the test for the 8th grade standardization, our understanding is that through rule and regulation, this is now a statewide standard test that is in place in all schools and all school districts. And as such, there will be no necessity for change. It's just recognizing that and taking advantage of it. Regarding my colleague from KC's consideration about whether this is existing PAWS, that is the case, that these are the tests that we're discussing, that we're looking at the reading tests that are currently in place for proficiency for those early years. And with regard to the lady senator's question on this weakening the growth model, That would also be an excellent lead-in, first of all, for the Second Amendment, where we very much strengthen the growth model concept. For the first couple of years, it is true that the growth model is probably not going to be what we're aiming for, but we're acknowledging the fact that we only have certain tools in place right now. When we're looking to the future and that future performance, we will certainly be focusing on more growth and performance-based modeling, and you'll see that when we start discussing that second Committee of the Whole Amendment, we'll definitely be targeting that to a level that I'm sure you'll be confident with. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for those clarification opportunities.
Thank you. Senator Cove.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the Chair bear some latitude here because clearly what my good friend from KC talks about is clearly in the next amendment. We do have a crossover effect here with these two, and I do apologize. If we'd have put it in one amendment, it would have been ridiculously big. And in answer also to my good friend from Natrona County, and we know the way of schools that go up and down, but the real key to how we wanted to start this thing, in our discussions in the interim, we knew that we didn't want to wait a year. We knew we wanted to kickstart this thing from the get-go and try to develop some criteria. Understanding that the random upside and the downside is there, I understand that. I've got schools in my district that go up and down. But this is a way to start, and we felt it was important to go ahead and start this way.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and one more question. And again, I think it relates to both amendments. Over the years, we have certain schools, because of their size, that we have not individually tracked nor released results. Is that still taken into account in both these two amendments? Let me give you an example. I have a school in my district, an elementary school, where if you identify, I'll go into a neighboring school district. There are two students in that school. If you release those, you've released the performance of those two students. That is not uncommon. Do we still protect those very, very small schools so people can't say all the things they say about a child who is less proficient than and there's no other kids in the grade? Do we still protect that under this system?
Senator Cove.
Oh, you called on me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this is an interesting situation because Wyoming is such a unique state. You do have schools with a couple of kids out there. I've got a school that's up southwest of where I live, up there about 35 miles, has four or five kids in it. This is something that I hope the design team can figure out how to deal with. I don't know how else we can do that. We have these very, very unique situations, and I'm hoping that the design team can deal with that particular situation.
Further discussion on the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. Question been called for. The motion is to adopt Senator Coe's motion, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 70. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment has been adopted. We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, Senate File 70. Will the reading clerk please read that amendment in?
Senate File 70, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, delete the Senate Standing Committee amendment.
Senator Cove.
Mr. Chairman, move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to Senate File 70 and defer to Senator Raffas.
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back again. All right. This particular amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, is going to deal with basically the rest of the bill to a large degree. And again, I'll go over its points of emphasis first, and then we'll walk through the amendment, which is a bit longer because it adds a lot more new language. The first thing that this amendment is going to do is beginning in school year 2012 through 13, the State Board is going to establish rules and regulations for the State Superintendent to receive scores for each student assessed by benchmark adaptive assessments with appropriate linkage to teachers, schools, and districts. So there's going to be a lot of language that's going to enable that. And again, this is a growth model assessment that is going to remain linked to the students, understanding that we have some difficulties with what the good senator from KC is discussing. But from the record side, we're going to have linkages to the students and the teachers of record so that we can track that performance throughout the school and track the growth. Again, this also addresses some of the concerns that we were hearing from the senator from Natrona County. At the same time, this test is going to eliminate some of the aspects, or excuse me, this amendment is going to eliminate some of the aspects from the statewide summative assessment, which we currently refer to as PAWS, which will include some of the more onerous aspects of writing, some of the in-depth additional requirements that aren't necessary to meet our national or our federal requirements. And it's also going to remove the open-ended testing aspect and the extended response and performance-based tasks. In other words, we're going to be simplifying the statewide summative assessment, recognizing that a lot of the data that we're looking for is now going to be given to the state, to the teachers, to the school districts by this new growth model system that we're looking at, the statewide, the benchmark adaptive assessments. So that's going to be a big difference and a big shift, but that's going to go into effect in the 2012-2013. That's when we'll really start having a lot of the growth model analysis online. Beyond that, in 2012-2013, we'll also be setting standards for the assessment of student growth in mathematics and reading for all children in grades K through 8, and we're going to try and have those correlated with the statewide assessment and accountability system. In other words, we're going to look for ways to link that adaptive assessment to our summative assessment for data analysis purposes. And there's some detail about how that's going to be administered for aligning the benchmarks and for the statewide assessment that we'll get into a bit. The direct assessment system is going to be integrated with the statewide accountability system and shall include, until 2012-2013, a body of evidence system to determine various levels of student performance. So what that means is that's that early system that we're talking about. Up to 2012-13, we're going to use that body of evidence system that we kind of have in place right now. Beyond that, we'll have a standardized benchmark assessment designed to measure student progress during the school year, which, as the bill states right now, is administered not less than twice per year in accordance with time periods and procedures established by the state board. The purpose of that is to have a beginning point for the school year and an end point for the school year as a minimum, established within specific date ranges so that we can be evaluating on a statewide basis and have the ability to compare school to school, grade to grade, and all of the other things that we want to be able to compare. We're trying to have an organized statewide approach to this, Mr. Chairman, so that we can measure growth across the school year. As the tall senator from Natrona County pointed out, there are serious considerations we have to look at when it comes to where these kids are starting when they arrive at school. They're not all arriving in an equal situation with an equal background and with equal parents. So when we're looking at the performance of a teacher, of a school, we have to be measuring how well those children are learning, are performing, are growing over the course of that year. And if we're not measuring at the beginning and the end, we're not going to end up with that good data. Furthermore, it adds to the Select Committee on Accountability the responsibility of reviewing the statewide assessment, together with the benchmark adaptive assessment. So that adds to some of the responsibility for this committee that we're looking at, the Select Committee. Now, in 2011-2012 school year, the State Board shall pilot the statewide benchmark adaptive assessment, and the results from the pilot shall be used to establish student achievement level alignment with the statewide summative assessment and student performance target levels for implementation of the 2012-2013. In other words, even that first year, we're going to try and pilot this adaptive system, this growth model system, so that we can use that data to help to align our two systems for that 2012-13 year where we're finally going to be looking at growth. Hopefully that's clear. It may not be. And finally, the State Board, through the superintendent, shall commence the development of standardized, multiple-choice, statewide summative assessment which satisfies No Child Left Behind and provides results to teachers and schools within the same year of assessment. Again, we're looking at ways that we can modify and improve this summative assessment so that it better complements this adaptive or formative assessment that we're looking at implementing and kind of minimizing the problems that we've been hearing about on some of that. So those are the key points. It's going to include a one-time appropriation of $265,000 to the Department of Education to develop that pilot program and develop that ability to bring those two programs together. And with that, I'm going to go through the amendment in conjunction with the bill and try and look through how this integrates into the document. All right, there's some minor modifications on page one that are just to bring the title into line and a small change at the beginning. So let's skip ahead to page 11, line 4. Now, page 11, line 4 inserts additional language, as you can see in the amendment, where effective school year 2012 through 13, the state superintendent shall, through the department, receive scores for each student assessed by each school district under the benchmark adaptive assessment administered under statute, with appropriate linkages to teachers, schools, and districts reported in formats and schedules established by rule and regulation of the state board. Now, that's going to be similar to a lot of the other language that we're going to see throughout this amendment, Mr. Chairman, as we bring this benchmark adaptive assessment into place. As a little side note, an awful lot of our school districts and schools right now are already using a benchmark adaptive assessment, sometimes more than once a year. In fact, some school districts are doing it three times a year and even four on occasion. So this is something that we have implemented in an informal capacity almost throughout the state. We're trying to bring this model into line with some statewide standards, rules, and regulations that will be promulgated so that we can have a better ability to analyze across the state the information that these systems provide us or these tests provide us. Moving on to page 14 after line 8. Where we are inserting the paragraphs that are shown at the bottom of page 1 of the amendment and on to page 2 of the amendment. Now, we're bringing these in, but they exist already in statute. So most of this isn't new language. What you can see on line 35, page 1 of the amendment, and line 38, page 1 of the amendment, is that we're striking out writing from the current system, the current standard system, which basically is PAWS, our statewide test. Striking out that writing aspect is obviously something that's going to make the test easier to deliver, and there's been a lot of concerns with the writing aspect. The language remains the same carrying through the bottom of the page, and then moving on to page 2 of the amendment, you can see that lines 3 through 9 have been struck, and that again is removing the essential point is probably the last sentence. The assessment system may also measure the common core of knowledge and skills established, which can be quantified. We're removing a lot of the emphasis on the current summative exam because we're going to be transferring that emphasis to these new adaptive assessments that we're working on, Mr. Chairman. All right, page 14, after line 21, we're inserting back this language. And what is being struck here, again, that's in statute, but the bill is now striking through amendment and open-ended testing such as constructed response, extended response, and performance-based tasks. That's taking out the open-ended aspect, that untimed, wide-open aspect of PAWS that, again, is something that leads to excessive expenses and excessive time for the bill. Since we have the new data, we don't feel that that's necessary anymore. Another key insertion you can see is on page 16 after line 14. Where we insert a significant amount of details regarding the benchmark adaptive assessment. That's effective school year 2012 through 13. And through benchmark adaptive assessments administered by school districts as a component of the district assessment, it will establish statewide standards for the assessment, and then it discusses that it's in grades kindergarten through grade 8, and these are to be separate from but correlated with the statewide assessment. It goes on to detail in A, B, and C, and moving on to D, some of the conditions for the administration of those benchmark adaptive assessments. And again, it's looking on a by grade level basis, by subject type basis, and really trying to come up with a system that emphasizes the broad diversity of parameters that we're going to need to truly end up with an accountability system that we're discussing. All right. Page 23, line 11. Excuse me, did I skip page 18 there? I'm sorry, moving back to page 18, my apologies. I skipped some substantive amendments there. You can see on page 18, line 8, there's an insertion of this B subpoint, which again brings in the standardized benchmark assessment designed to measure student progress during the school year, using a statewide adaptive standard of assessment set by the State Board of Education administered not less than 2 times a year, which is something that we discussed throughout. And again, most of this language is just bringing that into the system and the components for analyzing the school accountability. All right, now on to page 23. On page 23, line 11, you can see that we're deleting together with and then inserting subject to reporting from the state superintendent required under Section 5B of this Act. In addition, review of the statewide summative assessment shall be combined with the review of the statewide benchmark adaptive assessment required, and the select committee shall review that. So this is bringing into the considerations for the select committee as they're moving forward to establish the accountability system, this reporting on the statewide summative assessment. So again, we're trying to tie that summative assessment into the process as it's moving into phase two for consideration by the select committee. Moving on to page 4. Page 4 of the amendment, that is, page 4 of the Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, creates a Section 5, which is inserted on page 26 after line 15. And you can see that effectively what this does is discuss that pilot program that we talked about to bring the State Board of Education up to speed on this benchmark adaptive assessment program so that they're able to have it in place, figure out how it's going to be implemented for that first year, and look at the data for the first time as they're setting the performance standards for future years. The rest of the language is cleanup, and you can see on line 32 of page 4 that's where we see that appropriation of $265,000 to allow for this pilot program that the State Board of Education needs to accomplish to get us shifted over to a growth model as a primary emphasis, along with the summative model we're currently using instead of just the summative model. Hopefully that clarifies things, Mr. Chairman. And again, we stand open for questions on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, two questions. First, the jargon summative assessment, that's a new one on me. Could you explain what is meant by a summative assessment? Second question, a little more substance. Every time I see an assessment test being changed, I get concerned because education has often dealt with its problems of poor performance by simply dumbing down the measure. And I see an element of that in this by eliminating the writing test. And yes, writing's hard to test for, but it's very important. And from what I've seen on occasion from the product of a of our schools, particularly before we are doing any assessment testing at all, teaching writing is difficult and remains a problem. So can I be assured that we aren't, with the changes we're making, just dumbing the test down so they perform better?
Senator Nicholas. I'll same lines. As I understood from our interim work, a summative exam is pretty much what you think. It tests the summation of the learning skills that you've achieved, that school's achieved over time. So you go into third grade, eighth grade. We want to see not how you've grown year to year from where you began, but rather how is what's the summation of all the learning, and you measure that against your bench, your standards that you're setting for school districts or for the for accomplishments. We know that writing was difficult part of the pause to administer. It took time to get it back. But I, too, have a great concern that the pendulum is now moving from one end to the other end. I understand the on page two amendments, the open-endedness, but I can tell you with the, as I watch children of my children's age go through school, one of the areas where they were not proficient was in writing. It's easy to force your kids to read. It's harder to force them to write. You have kids going through engineering college and still can't write. Just go look at your directions of any of your iPods or whatever. But this writing is interesting. Now, by having it in the test, what it did is force teachers to give more attention to writing. As I've conferred with elementary school teachers, they are now focusing more highly on writing. And my impression is that children who have been living under these rules over the last few years are becoming better writers because more time is spent during the school day writing. And I also believe, from talking to folks and listening, that there are other ways to test for writing. You need not have to necessarily write, but to take writing out and say, we're not even going to test for it. The message you send is it's no longer important. If you want to tell them, let's devise a better way to test, fair enough. But to eliminate it as an area and say it's no longer important, and then turning over the page two, I wonder about the elimination of some of the state content and performance standards, which are things we put a lot of energy into, to make sure that we have benchmarks that we want to achieve. It seems like we're saying the benchmarks are no longer important. If we digress, if we digress back to simply saying we don't care where you end as long as during the year you grow. You can start low and grow mediocre. You can grow mediocre and always have growth. So I guess I, too, have a big concern as to whether what we've done is taking the pendulum that moved too far to the right and now taking it all the way to the left, abandoning some of the good ideas that we've achieved.
Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll go through. I got a couple questions. Working off the amendment on page 2, lines 14, 15, and part of 16. As I recall, those constructed response, extended response, and tasks were put in for students on IEPs and with some sort of disabilities, so they didn't have to, and that's what they were in there for. What happens to those children, and do we need that different way to respond? Going on down the page to line 38, 39, and again, as I read this, we are talking about State Board of Education in subparagraph B on line 38. Prescribe growth by subject area and by grade level. My understanding is we're trying to measure whether students are progressing, and tell me more what prescribed growth, what that actually means when you start defining it in terms of the standards, which is what this is. And again, Mr. Chairman, over on the top of page 3, again, we're talking about standards established by the State Board of Education, the use of assessment results to design strategies, and as I understand that, State Board of Education is telling what the strategies will be to remedy schools that are having trouble. Ease my mind on something like that, would you please?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess at the end of the day, I'd just like to find out whether or not we've got continuity, and I'm trying to remember whether the correct word is longitudinal continuity between what we have been testing and how that works, whether we can look at what we have been doing and as this implementation goes in and how it's going to work in the future. I'm concerned we may have to wait several years before we actually know whether this is the right way to test people if we have to have that grade period. I believe it was from 3rd to 8th, whether we have to wait that long to find out whether this is the best test in the world. I'm wondering whether with this particular test and in addition of another kind of a test, whether or not we're increasing or decreasing the time students are tested in the classroom. And I'm a little concerned with as far as the pendulum is swinging. A few years ago, the State Board of Education basically didn't do much of anything. They were almost ceremonial. And now the State Board of Education has taken on a lot more duties and responsibilities. And I'm trying to understand what the fiscal impact might be as far as having to provide more people to the board or whether they're simply just going to use the experts within the Department of Education. So there's a few things here as far as how things are going to work, how we're going to pay for them, what we're actually getting at the end of the day. And I guess I would say that there are some schools that can meet those performance standards and can increase. I know my little local school of LaGrange had 5 years in a row where they made these benchmarks and grew in all of the subject matters. So I know it can be done, but just really kind of curious about some of those particular areas, especially time in the classroom testing and whether or not this information can be used and whether or not we meet any federal standards as far as that might need to be met.
Mr. President.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just a few comments, and I'll say right from the get-go, I think this is a good amendment, although there's been some questions that could probably be better addressed in a third reading amendment or second or third reading amendments as we go down the road. I, too, would be one that would like to continue to include writing, and I won't go into a long discourse as to why, but it's a very important skill. I think it's part of the 3 R's as we know it. I think we are getting better at not only teaching writing, but we're getting better at assessing it. I, for one, and I'll just have to openly say that I taught second grade for 12 years, and I got many children coming into my class, or I got a number of children that came into my class could not yet read. And one of the things that I discovered and gave me a great deal of success into teaching reading and writing simultaneously, and I did that as you kids learn to write what they read and read what they write, and then they begin thinking. And so it becomes an integrated skill. What I think I can write, what I can write, I can read, and others can read, and others can, and that whole thing is a continuum. So at some point I'm looking at trying to amend that back in. But that's no reason to fault this amendment. This is a very good amendment. The other thing that I would say in regard to, and it's been brought up, I think, from the good senator from KC, page 2 in those lines, 14, 15, in regard to the striking of those open-ended testing as a constructive response, extended response, and performance-based tasks, I think that just broadens the way you do this type of an assessment. you know, just to go strictly to multiple choice, I think really does narrow, and I hate to use a term that's already been used, but some ways it does dummy down the ability to respond, and so this gets to a different level of children. That's something else. Very good amendment, but I think this is a way that we can embellish it and work it in the beginning. And then I'm not going to take time to talk too much in regard to what prescribed growth by subject area and by level. That was also brought up by the good senator from KC, lines 38 and 39. To me, that says that there's a prescription regard. A prescription is made in regard to the anticipated amount of growth or prescribed or the appropriate amount of growth within a subject area or by the grade level, and that might even be an IEP for a student who was in special education or something like that, but it addresses the ability appropriately through prescription that would be appropriate to the grade level as well as to the subject. Exactly how that I've lost a lot of my training and testing and measurements and psychometry and some of that, but that's what it says to me. But with that, I think that those are some things that can be corrected perhaps as we go along. I think this is an outstanding amendment, and I think it really gets at some of the things that we find that we've been wrestling with sometimes. It would leave some work to be done by the design team, if you so desire in that. And I would hope that you'd support the amendment, but I, too, will be looking at some future, perhaps, corrective amendments to make those adjustments in the areas we just talked about. So with that, again, I hope you'd give this amendment your favorable consideration. Thank you so much.
Senator Cove.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, in the interim, remember that we're plowing new ground here. We don't have any type of a track record in coming in with an Education Accountability Act. We just don't have one. We started out this process saying, you know, we want to do something about it. We are serious about accountability. That's where this bill came from. We kick-started it with the two cores. As a good Mr. President said, he liked the third core as well, and maybe we'll see an amendment to that effect. But one of the things that came in that we all heard in the interim, pause. This became a nasty, ugly word before we came down here. Now, we had testimony in our committee one day from an expert from California who's looked at all the summative testing that goes on all across the country. He didn't like any of it except this test, the PAWS test. But this is the best summative test that's out there he's ever seen. Now, did we have a problem administering that test? Absolutely. Do we want to give this design team the flexibility to be able to come in and say, let's lay it back on the table, let's look at the test, the assessment, the growth assessment, let's lay it on the table and have a discussion about it? So remember that this process you see here is going to go in front of a design team. They're going to work hard in the interim, and I think I'm going to be involved in it, whether I want to or not, because that's what it says. But remember the debate we had on PAWS. Everybody heard about it. This is what we're trying to address. If you look on page 3 under paragraph B, you'll see that particular testing assessment there. That's specifically designed to address MAP testing. Now, the MAP test is a snapshot that they can take practically every week if they want to see how a kid's doing. That's what that addresses. But the total overall test that we're talking about, this gives the design team the flexibility to go out in the interim and say, is PAWS a good test? Maybe. Should writing be involved in it? Maybe, probably. So remember, that's the flexibility in this amendment. I think it's a good amendment, and ask that you support it.
Senator Erfurth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to come up and address some of the very good points that my fellow senators were bringing up, and I think there is a lot of potential for some good amendments along the lines of the discussion that we had. Looking over the concerns of the senator from Natrona County, the tall one, the summative assessment, I believe my fellow colleague from Albany County mentioned, is basically just a point-in-time summation of the knowledge of the individual and should be measured from school to school as opposed to the growth of the individual. The idea that both of the senators discussed about dumbing down the test by taking out writing, and it was discussed otherwise, There's certainly no intent to dumb down the test. The concern with the writing aspect was not to move away from writing. Obviously, as the president discussed as well, this is an essential part. And I can speak firsthand from my teaching at the University of Wyoming that we need to go a long ways further with getting our writing improved. I grade an awful lot of very bad writing. And if there is anything we can do to improve that, I would appreciate it personally. But it's the concept of whether that's appropriate in a summative exam, whether it's reasonable and easy to facilitate, and it's been very difficult. That's been a point of difficulty with the pause test, and that's something that has been identified as a real fundamental problem. The concept of teaching to the test for writing on a standardized test is so difficult that it forces a lack of creativity in the writing styles. It forces a strict adherence to one approach for writing, when in fact I think we all know that writing is a very subjective type of thing. You know good writing when you read it, but it's very difficult to define what that good writing is. When we create a standardized test that forces everyone to adhere to one model of good writing, I think it only hurts our education system. And that's one of the primary concerns for withdrawing it from that summative assessment. There is nothing that suggests in this piece of legislation or this amendment that we don't want to be testing writing. We're going to try and look for ways, phase two, where we're trying to identify how we want to move forward with growth models, with summative assessments, where we can go. That's definitely one of the things that we've talked about doing and we heard in testimony that we need to do. We need to find ways to do a good job of measuring both growth and performance in writing. It's just that from what we've heard, and it's why it's in this amendment, the pause is not doing that. It's ending up a large waste of resources. When you have a situation where you've got a statewide standardized test, you have to have significant statistical significance. I was a little bit redundant there, excuse me. You have to have a preponderance of statistical significance so that you can say that it's credible data for the kids, which means that it's not enough just to have one person in a couple of minutes read through these things. You have to have redundancy, and you have to have multiple readings. It ended up being quite onerous, and that was one of the reasons to remove it. So I don't want anyone to think that this particular amendment is trying to dumb anything down. In fact, what we're doing is we're trying to give some flexibility to the select committee and the advisory committee to come up with ways that we can actually improve the rigor and improve what we're doing as we're moving forward, but not doing it in the same onerous fashion that we're doing right now and trying to adjust for the needs of the students. Let's see. The senator from KC had what I consider to be a very good point that I do think that we need to give some thought to. When we're looking at amending on page 2, lines 14 through 16, his concern was what happens with IEPs if we delete that language, and that's a concern that I now share. We'll have to look into that and see if that is language that's specifically for the IEPs or not. Again, the reason for striking this language, and this language is specific to the statewide summative exam, is to try and narrow the parameters for that summative exam, because it is so open-ended right now that we're hearing a lot of complaints about how long it takes, the fact that it's taking weeks to accomplish these objectives, and we've heard nothing good about the fact that it's taking weeks. So the intent of striking those lines was to make this thing go a little bit more quickly so that we're not having all the kids spend their time doing testing when they should probably be learning. That's the intent behind it, and hopefully you can stand behind that, but we're certainly open to hearing more ideas about it. The prescribed growth by subject area and by grade level on lines 38 and 39, what is that prescribed growth? That's going to be a subject of much consideration by the select committee and the advisory committee. That's exactly what we have to identify, is how much growth do we need, what performance levels are satisfactory. Those types of things are what we're looking forward to, which is why that language is intentionally somewhat vague. Moving on to some additional concerns by my fellow senator about longitudinal continuity. That is something that is going to be emphasized as we're moving forward, trying to come up with this benchmark adaptive assessment where we're tracking it with the student, with the teacher of record, with their principals and administrators. That's one of the emphasis or key points of emphasis of this amendment. The idea about whether or not we're just doing 3rd through 5th and then skipping to 8th and 11th and not having any other information, That's something that's probably true for the first year, realistically, because the first year we're just going with what we've got. As we move towards the adaptive exams and as we're looking to the phase two, it says in this amendment that we're going to be doing these adaptive exams K through 8 each and every year to track the child's individual growth both at the beginning and at the end of the school year. So, in fact, we'll have a very good record of the growth in both reading and math over that entire time period, and that'll be a much better detail of the growth of the student over time than what we have right now. Whether it's increasing or decreasing the amount of time used, the intent is clearly to decrease the amount of time used. These adaptive benchmark tests are quick. They tend to be about 40 minutes long. You do them twice a year in two different subjects. That's a total of 160 minutes over the course of the year, which is far less than what PAWS is taking up in a lot of cases right now. Whether the pendulum is swinging too far is certainly a consideration, but I don't feel that the pendulum is swinging too far on this. We've got the phase two. We're trying to make sure that it maintains its rigor. It's just that we're not really happy with what we have right now. And then finally, whether or not this integrates well with our current system. That's something that we're looking for over the next couple of years, is ways to integrate our previous data, our previous historical summative data through the PAWS, with the future adaptive data. And that's why we're not recommending any specific significant changes to the PAWS as it's going to occur over the next year or two. Remember, that pilot program is trying to allow us to do that integration. So there was some thought given to that. Now, all of that said, Mr. Chairman, there's certainly areas that might need to be amended. We look forward to hearing your amendments on it. But for right now, I would certainly urge the body's favorable consideration of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 on Senate File 70, and would be happy to answer any further questions if there are any.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, compliment the co-sponsors for giving a lot of thought to this. Going back to the issue of the summative exams, listening to the consultants this summer and looking at the language, it at least finally came to occur to me that the issue wasn't necessarily changing the language, deleting writing, going in and saying these are things that it wasn't really the language that was creating the problem. Rather, it was the lack of constraint for testing time. So if you leave the same language in and then you go out to your advisory committee, you tell the advisory committee, you tell us what is an appropriate time to test a student. And if the advisory committee says, well, an appropriate time to test students is 3 hours a day for 4 days, no more. That's all the time you've got. Then from there, you have all these things, and the committee that's constructing the exam has to figure out how to get a test administered in that amount of time. If you take you go over to the Supreme Court in Wyoming, and they say you've got a 30-page brief. You're going to deliver your argument in 15 minutes. And I'm fascinated that people do it all the time. If you didn't put that constraint on them, the arguments would be 3 days and you'd be going on. I suspect when you teach classes, you're teaching a whole semester of work, but you're limited by a test that's 1 hour. And ultimately, you're going to confine. And it's not that you didn't intend everybody to learn all the material or that you didn't intend for them to write or things like that. You're just constrained by the examination time. And I kind of think that one of the things we lost track of is this notion that if what we want to do is test to the benchmarks, then if we're going to make sure every benchmark is made, and that was the direction that we gave to the person drafting the exam, they say, well, I'm going to test to every benchmark. And that was a great idea. I mean, you'd make sure that it's like a year in exam. We don't care how long it takes. Now, I'm not sure that test your fluency, because we want people to come to the answer quickly, too. I mean, you can have an open book exam and take the whole summer and, I assume, affect your grade. But we don't want to do that. So I wonder, as we're thinking through this over the course of the next day, if we don't simply solve the problem by saying This is the volume of time allowed for testing, period. Now, examiners, you go back and you figure out how to get a test done in that amount of time.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, I think that last suggestion is a very good one, but on the issue of dumbing the test down, writing is part of the concern on that, but only part of it. And what I'm looking for as this bill goes forward is some precautions so that as the tests are redone and revised here, which is what I understand is going on, they don't dumb down all the rest of the content.
Senator Rufus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, Senator. I meant to address that in the previous discussion. This adaptive test that we're very likely to use is a few different ones at the national level that are already in place. I don't want to name the corporations that sponsor them. The adaptive term is the key. We're not going to really have any effect on what the problems are, what the test questions are like. What we're going to do, basically, is sit them down at a computer. They're going to take the test from this national corporation that administers it, and the test adapts to the student. It actually gives you a couple of questions. You answer the questions based on how you're answering. It gives you a new series of questions, and it figures out where you stand, and it gives you a score. And basically, everyone, this oversimplifies it, but everyone kind of takes the same test. It's just that if you're in eighth grade, you should end up hopefully somewhere around the eighth grade level at the end of it. If you're in second grade, you'll probably end up somewhere around the second grade at the end of it. For the earlier tests, there's certainly some differences. But if we do this adaptive assessment concept, there's really no concern, in my view, of dumbing it down. What we'll end up with is a lot of data about where people stand relative to other students, not only in the state but across the country. So we'll have a good benchmark versus other countries. We'll also have other states, I should say. We'll have good data on the growth of the students over the course of the year relative to their own previous performance. So the test that we're looking at adding, this concept of growth, certainly isn't going to dumb anything down because it is a nice assessment on where students stand. And then towards the end, we'll probably continue to remain with some of these summative assessments that we're currently using, which are the college readiness assessments, and those obviously are not going to be dumbed down in any standard either. Thank you.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we leave this, I would like to change the subject, going back over to page 12 of the bill. Lines 9 through 13, I think this is the first time in any of these bills that we bring out school principals of record. And my question to the committee is a lot of what we've been talking about is measuring student performance, and in this instance we're beginning to look at the issue of measuring that performance against the teachers of record, the school principals of record. And my question then is twofold. One is, did the committee talk about this with respect to the principals and give thought to how this is going to work? And there is no provision, as I see, for trying to provide measurements for superintendents who hire the principals. Is that simply because we omitted it during the interim, or is it because it's not appropriate to hold the superintendents accountable all the way to the top? But if we're talking about a system of education that begins at the top all the way to down, have we hit the mark? Have we given enough attention to principals and superintendents?
Senator Rufus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My good colleague from Albany County will probably be a little bit annoyed to realize that one feature of this amendment on page 3, line 19, if you look at it, is to actually strike out the very phrase that you were referring to, which is "and school principals of record." The reason for that amendment was based on the realization that there really apparently aren't school principals of record. To be honest with you, that's a little bit unclear to me why that is. This bill and this amendment does try to some degree to tie the school principals in, but that language doesn't really exist yet, and I I'm actually not sure that it does go far enough to tie in the administrators and the superintendents. We've had a lot of discussion about that. We were contemplating whether or not that should be an additional bill, maybe for another session, whether there was a way for us to tie in at this point. I think everyone probably agrees that it needs to be tied in. I'm not sure that this goes far enough, but I do know that there is language in here, and I can sort through it to try and find that and sit down with you and work on it. But I'm not sure it goes far enough. Thank you.
Senator Nicholas.
I would hope that as we leave here, at least we assign to the advisory committee the task of focusing on superintendents and principals equal to that which we begin to talk about teachers. So I do look forward to some more thought with respect to that.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, if we are going to talk about accountability, I think the good senator from Albany County brings up a good point. We're going to bring principals in, talking about teachers. We need to talk about school boards. We need to talk about parental accountability. Have superintendent accountability would be a good amendment, and I'd welcome that.
Question been called on. All in favor of committee of the whole second amendment to Senate File 70, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Question has been called on the bill. Senator Scott.
One quick question that I don't think was covered in either of the amendments. As I understand it, this is an assessment. We're trying to do an assessment of at the school level. And I know some of the schools in my district were a very mobile society, and you get a lot of turnover within the classroom during a year. That the students who are in the classroom at the end of the year are not the same students that take the growth test at the beginning of the year. How do you deal with that problem in this new system?
Senator Rufus.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. Again, to the Tall Center from Natrona County, that is one of the keys to this concept, and the longitudinal studies and linking the student to the teacher of record intends to cover just that point, actually, among others. We did have a lot of discussion about this mobility. If you're keeping for partial periods of years, if you recognize that there is mobility and you track that, and we've discussed that as being one of the factors that we need to make sure is brought into this as it moves forward into phase two, if you keep track of that, then you can do a better job of looking at the growth and the discontinuity of growth and the people who end up having high mobility. If we had, say, three times a year instead of two times a year for this benchmark adaptive assessment, which might be the subject of a potential future amendment, then that would even give further definition. So you could be looking at an individual for a half a year that was in the classroom. So there are a lot of options there. A lot of thought has been given to that, and it's a concern that we heard a lot about in our testimony in the committee. Thank you, Mr. President.
All those in favor of Senator Cole's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 70, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 70 have passed the committee of the whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 146. Reading clerk, please read the file.
Senate File 146, Teacher Accountability Act, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Coe, Jennings, Landon, Rossbuth, Senator Coe, Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 146 and defer to the sponsor of the Senate file, Senator Nicholas.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, Senate File 146 was brought about by giving some thought to the difficulty and this issue of tenure, the issue with respect to what it is that or how is it that we go about making sure that teachers are doing their part in a system? I think most of us view the system of education as one involving parents, the school boards, the superintendents, principals, and then teachers. And as we saw the earlier tenure bills, part of what the exercise that I did was go back and just start looking at the dictionary. What is tenure? What does it mean? What doesn't it mean? And tenure, I think, is if you begin to do the research, means different things to me, different people. In one dictionary definition, you can read it to say it is a guarantee of a job. In others, and if you look back historically as I read the concept of tenure was developed at a time when we were losing good teachers because principals would come in, fire good teachers, hire their brother, hire their sister, hire their friends, and ultimately good teachers were leaving the profession. And the first ideas of tenure were simply this. It was a contract to say that we will only hire and fire you based upon job-related performance. So if you think in terms of a probationary teacher being able to fire for any reason, you can fire them because you don't like the clothing they wear. You can fire them because you don't like their teaching styles. There's another aspect of this whole evaluation system that if you go back to the original concept, and that is we want to recruit good teachers, we want to keep good teachers, and part of recruiting them is saying, look, if you move to our community, you pick up your job here, and this is your chosen profession, what we'll promise you is this. What we promise you is you will only be hired and fired for job-related performance. And so in its abstract, tenure makes perfect sense. The question is that I began to think about, and why is it, if that's what we intended, that has tenure become a perception that it's a guarantee of a job? And I began to answer my own question as I researched it and as I began to look at and think of my own experiences doing employment issues for contract or for employment folks or employers. All employers are going to encounter the problems of how you document the discharge of employee, because even if you're in the private sector, if you want to fire somebody that's over 45, that's subject to the age discrimination complaints, if you want to fire somebody that's of any protected class, there are all of a sudden special rules that come into place. And even then, what happens oftentimes is employers come to me, said, I've got a person that's a protected class, and he's not a good employee, and you begin to say, well, have you documented it? How are you going to prove to the court that your reason is related to work performance and not because they're in this protected class or they're a whistleblower or retaliation? And unfortunately, most employers, when they come to you, haven't even given any thought about how they're going to document the lack of performance of any employee. And if you got rid of tenure tomorrow, you could still have the same problem. If you said, well, I've heard the notion that, you know, if you're just going to riff based upon age, first out, I should have said that the last person to be hired, the first to be fired. If that's what you're going to do, fair enough. But if you want to go through and you're going to have a reduction in force, you want to begin to look at quality of teachers. And what we really want to do is keep our best teachers, and we're going to riff based upon performance. Same question is, how are you going to go about measuring this performance? You're going to measure them because of the people you like. You're going to measure them because of a variety of other things. I already explained to you my own experience. That is, when I hear people say, we all know who the bad teachers are, I would challenge that, because if you sit around your friends of 30 or 40, even 100 people, They're probably like you. They may attend the same church. Your kids might be of the same, along the same learning platform. And but if you walked three blocks over and met people that are not in your group, you might find that they too know who the teachers are that are performing, only they aren't the same teachers that you think. Different children perform better with different teachers. That's a truth that I think we all are seeing. We wouldn't need charter schools if everybody learned the same. If everybody learned the same, we wouldn't be talking about, well, there's creative writing, there's a form of writing. So given that, what I'd like to start you off with is if you look at the existing law with respect to reasons for termination in the Wyoming statutes, you would go over into this bill to page 6 and 7. In Wyoming statute presently as exists today, there's a list of reasons why you can terminate a teacher who's under a contract, a 10-year contract. And I've broken them out here on page 7, item by item. But presently, as you can see, you can fire a teacher for incompetency, neglect of duty, immorality, insubordination, and actually goes on any other good and just cause relating to the educational process. So already in statute, there's provision, a method to terminate a teacher who's not performing well. Why is it so expensive? Why doesn't it seem to work to people's opinion? And I think the answer is the bill that we just came off with. The issue is, how do we design a system of evaluation that we can judge and create empirical data so that we can actually terminate employee teachers for non-performance? And what this bill proposes to do is to build off of all the principles we set out in Senate File 70, to take the notion of these growth assessments and start to develop a system where we can administer growth assessments throughout the year and measure how students are performing by teacher, and then find ways to test the teachers to see to evaluate teachers against these performance standards. And then, once again, turning over to page 6 and 7, what we do, we've increased the reasons why you can terminate a teacher who is subject to tenure to add in physical incapacity to perform job duties without reasonable accommodation. During the evaluation of this language, there are out on the Internet or other places lists of every state and the reasons that they can terminate. And I went through each one of those and looked, and if it looked like we were missing something in our statute, I added in. This is one of those areas that our statute didn't address. Failure to perform duties in a satisfactory manner is a language that's commonly found in other states and I felt should be brought into our statute. But here's the key area, lines 17 through 20. Inadequate performance is determined through annual performance evaluations tied to student academic growth completed in accordance with the statute. Now we'll take you back through the beginning of the bill and walking forward. When you take a look at page 2, lines 12 through 24, what we're going to do now, if this bill were to pass, is require annual assessments of teachers and their performance. Now, it's going to be based in part on the academic growth measures that is prescribed by law and upon longitudinal data systems linking student achievement with teachers of record. This is a discussion that we've already had. Well, this bill requires the same advisory committee and the select committee to devise and figure out how we're going to perform these links. Now, there are others. This is not a brand new idea. There are a couple other states that are beginning this walk down here. Other states have said, well, 50% of the evaluation is going to be based upon these links. Others have said 80%. In this language, I propose to just say it be based in part. We'll leave it to the interim work to devise and determine whether it's 50%, 60%, or even greater. But we'll leave that to something not to be solved at this session, but we'll be taking a look at it later. In this provision, we put at the bottom of two and taking over the top three, we make clear that the performance evaluation system shall also include reasonable opportunity for district provision for mentoring and professional development. That's something we're already doing. Frankly, we have a lot of invested in these teachers. Many of them may have gone through Wyoming schools. They may have gone through the UW. And we certainly want to make sure that before we terminate teachers, that we've made sure that we can't, if you will, rehabilitate our investments to make sure that there's an opportunity for these teachers to improve. Now, the next couple pages say that talk about the probationary teachers and non-probationary teachers. If you're a probationary teacher, a non-contract teacher, you will not obtain your tenure status until you've demonstrated that you have and have satisfactorily achieved growth performance in your students, and that really turns over to pages 4 and the top of page 5. But we want to know that they performed well in these performance evaluations. So in this sense, we're going to, before you're offered a continuing contract, we want to know, have you taken your students and have you achieved the type of growth that we are expecting? Now, over on page 6, we began to deal with the issue of, let's take a look at the termination process. We've heard complaints about the difficulty of terminating teachers, and while we might agree or disagree with the cost associated with whether it's appropriate cost, it appears to me that there's one area that we can begin to deal with, and that's effective immediately. Instead of requiring communities to go out and hire independent hearing officers and then argue about the role of those hearing officers, that is, are they there to regulate the hearing process, or are they there to actually take the evidence and make findings of fact and conclusions of law? What this does is turn that process over to the Office of Administrative Hearings. By acronym, we've learned to call them the OAH. And that is a group of lawyers that are state employees that do workers' compensation hearings. They do environmental quality hearings. They do a variety of hearings. And frankly, what we've learned over time is they're independent. They seem to understand the politics of it. They seem to stay out of the politics and have done a good job of really trying to keep these hearings tight, get them to the end. And in this instance, we're going to ask the OAH hearing examiners to actually take, not only conduct the hearings, but to make findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations to the board. So it's not anticipated the board members will even be at these hearings. Then turning over, we'll talk about that a little bit. We talked about I began by talking about pages 6 through 7, which are the additional provisions for making it clear for teachers that if you don't perform, your quality is not there, you'll be terminated, and we're going to create the database. So now the database is there. We have an empirical basis by which to judge your skill levels, and if you're not there, you can be terminated for not showing not being able to measure growth. Why do we pick growth assessments? Well, the summative exams aren't given every year, so they're not appropriate there. And moreover, we want to recognize the issues that our colleagues have talked about, and that is each teacher is given different students. And let's measure your skill levels by what the students that you received kept through the entire year and see whether those students achieve the growth that we think they ought to have achieved. The next page is, I'll sort of skip over and go right to Section 3. And Section 3 is what directs the work back to the advisory committee. as well as the select committee created under Senate File 70 to take this concept and make it workable and bring it down to integrating the two concepts. Over on page 11 through 12, while it is not common that we put intent provisions in the legislative act, it seemed to me it was appropriate this time to talk about 10-year and what it is that it's what we see as the difficulties and what we intend to achieve by this. So if you look over page 11, lines 14 through 19, what we intend to achieve by 10 years is that the fundamental premise that 10 years is to protect competent teachers from arbitrary termination for reasons unrelated to teaching performance. On the other hand, if you're not performing, it's our intention that we have a system that regardless of whether you have a contract or not, you can be terminated, and you can be terminated in a cost-effective manner. Items 2 through 5, or the pages 12 through 13, essentially develop those ideas and make clear that we believe that 10-year is not there to protect incompetency. Rather, it's there to protect good teachers from being arbitrarily fired. Over on page 13, we know that the OAH process is going to have some fiscal impacts. It's going to have some employment impacts. And we're directing that the appropriation committee takes a look at that. Right now, the notion is that when a district uses these services, they would pay for the cost of those lawyers. Now, they don't pay them at the cost that you would pay a private lawyer. Rather, it's what we call internally, and there'd be what's equivalent to an internal service cost. And my recollection the last time is the cost of these attorneys is about $50 an hour at our cost by hiring them as employees. And that's charged to the districts that would be using them. We do the same thing in state government. If the office, if an agency needs to have a hearing, they secure the services of OAH. OAH then assigns a cost to those use of that, but at its actual government cost. If you want to rent a car from in the state, or you want to check out a state car, that agency pays an internal service fee to the Department of A&I, Administration and Information, to cover the cost of that vehicle, and that is a common feature. And why we could assess this broadly on all districts so that they're all bearing a proportionate cost, and that's something we may want to look at it, but as a practical matter, it does seem to me that we want to promote good employment decisions from the beginning, and part of the way you do that is to say there ought to be some cost if you're having to fire teachers that you've already hired. Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions. I want to be sure that I understand the bill and what we're doing, and it's more in the probationary part of the existing law that we have. And if you look on page 6, line 22, dismiss any teacher, now we're changing that for the first 3 years to add additional language, specifically on 7, lines 17 through 20, which if you go over to the next page, on page 8, line 3, are any teachers. So as I read this, we're now going to have more requirements for the first 3 years before we can actually do it. We now will have hearings. We'll be in the Office of Administrative Hearings and more facts, more attorneys, more proceedings to be going through for the first 3 years. And the reason I asked that question, and Mr. Chairman, I received an email from a school district in Fremont County that shows after 3 years, only 47% of probationary teachers were offered continuing contracts, and of the remaining 39% were not offered, and 14% saw fit to leave. That's over a 5-year period. Now, if you add all this additional requirements, proceedings, hearings, what is this going to do to the process we already have set up? It seems to me like, you know, we're here to talk about tenure and we're talking about the continuing contract, yet as I read this, there's a whole lot of changes you're doing to the first 3 years.
Senator Nicholas.
There are no changes to the probationary status with respect to their at-will status. None at all. When you turn the page, in that respect, the existing statutes all are alike. When you turn over to the page 6 at the bottom, this only refers to the continuing contract teachers and the basis for termination. What we are saying, though, is that before a probationary employee is provided a continuing contract, one of the requirements is that they show that they perform satisfactorily performance evaluations under these new tests. So what you're looking at page 4 to 5 is simply this. You cannot become in the first instance a continuing contract teacher without having shown performed satisfactory on these performance evaluations. But with respect to the probationary employee, the same is true. Nothing changes. You can be hired and fired with will without any explanation of reasons, but you cannot achieve the continuing contract without having shown that you, in fact, meet these new requirements.
Senator Bebout.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's not the way I read it. I go to page 8. Any continuing contract teacher receiving notice of a recommendation of termination, so on and so forth, or any teacher. Now, that tells me that's any teacher that from the day they're hired, then you go on to say dismissal, and then you say provided through the Office of Administrative Hearings. And maybe there's something I'm missing, but you're adding any teacher in that particular category, which includes probationary or non-probationary. And there's a whole different set of circumstances by how I read that they're treated.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, to respond to my good colleague from Fremont County, the only teachers that are even entitled to proceedings are teachers that are under a continuing contract. Your first three-year teachers, they don't get any proceedings anyway because they're at will. I think you're reading more into this than what's there. If they're that in that first three-year period, when it's time to let them go, you just let them go. You don't have to renew their contract. There's no proceedings. Nothing's changed for those initial first 3 years. It's only when they earn continuing contract status that they're even entitled to a proceeding.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, I agree with the last explanation and would go on to say that with respect to a mid-year termination of a one-year contract, you would still want to give the, if you're going to have a hearing on that mid-year termination, mid-contract termination, which we all have, we've talked about that in the last bill, that would also be front of the OAH. But if there's any doubt, we can clear that up. Just to make perfectly clear, it's the intention of this bill not to provide any new rights to probationary teachers. It is intended that before you achieve your new status or for new probationary teachers to achieve a status as continuing, that there would be an evaluation to show that you have accomplished and met taking your students on a growth or through a process of growth repeat for those 3 years. And however, if you terminate a probationary teacher mid-year, if you choose to do that as opposed to just hiring them throughout the year, there also is a hearing process that may be available for them just for that exercise, and that would move into the Office of Administrative Hearings so that you wouldn't have to go out and hire an independent hearing officer. And if we've not done a good job of achieving those goals, then we do need to make amendments.
Senator Von Vleden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also confused. I do believe the good senator from Fremont has a point on page 8 on line 3 where you added any teacher. Do they somehow, in the existing statutes, do all teachers have a right to a hearing for dismissal or suspension? I didn't think they did. So it looks like you're adding something. But my original question was, on page 5B, lines 6 through 13, I know that in most districts, at least in mine, and maybe in every district, and maybe it's somewhere else in statute, they honor the time spent in another district. They recognize it. So they'll actually, you go right into continuing contract status if you've served 3 and 4 and 5 years in another district. I think this precludes that. I think this says you have to have 3 years somewhere else, pass the performance evaluation, and then who without lapse of time has taught 2 consecutive school years and has had his contract renewed for a 3rd consecutive school year by the employing school district. So I think you can work 4 years somewhere else, come in, if you work at least 2 years with us, have passed the evaluation on your 3rd contract, we can make you a continuing contract teacher. But I know our district recognizes time spent in other school districts in Wyoming, and that goes for benefits and for continuing contracts. So I think this precludes it, and does there any wiggle room for districts to recognize it sooner or to recognize time spent in other districts in Wyoming?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I have a different set of concerns about this bill. Seems to me that we've got a system that's broke. Our system for dealing with teachers once they're in the continuing contract system is not effective, because when you get a teacher whose performance is not satisfactory, by and large, the school districts are unwilling to do anything about it because the process is too long, too costly, and too uncertain, because it depends on pretty legalistic interpretations of the documentation. It depends on more documentation than they typically have. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, when I worked for the federal government way back when, I encountered the same problem in civil service, that you didn't want to get rid of the unperforming people in your office because you'd spent all your time on the legalistic process of getting rid of them and wouldn't get your basic job done. So it was the last thing you wanted to do. And I think we've got the same system in our school employment. Now, as I read this bill, it proceeds on the theory that we haven't set the right criteria. And that's what's going on when you look at the changes on particularly line 7. You've got general criteria, incompetency and neglect of duty, and then you essentially, what being added is some more specific things along that line. And I don't see that as changing the fundamental problem, which I think is in the process. Now, there is a change of the process here. We're going to use the Office of Administrative Hearings, Mr. Chairman, in making the initial decisions. And the question I've got, is that change in the process going to do us any good? The problem we've got, as I see it, in the current system, is that you instantly go to court and you have all the evidentiary rules, you have all the difficulties of proving anything, and it is extraordinarily slow, expensive, and time-consuming, and does justice to neither side because of those factors. And how is the OAH process going to be any different? It seems to me we need a sea change in the way things are done so that we can get to a very different process where you've got a much easier standard of proof, because the ones we've got lead to this legalistic system that simply doesn't work. So that's my concern with this bill, that it's a misdiagnosis of the problem, and that the solution that's offered to the process problems doesn't help.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think all we have to do is go into a workers' comp situation and know that the office of OAH does work, because previously in workers' comp, everything went to the courts, and we needed to streamline that system. And so things go to OAH, and they very seldom go to the rise to the level of district court once that determination of fact and that decision has been made. And so, you know, I think if we look back in history, we could see that workers' comp is really a model for the OAH to streamline the legal system, to decrease the costs associated with the legal system, and to come to a resolution in a quicker and a much more, I think, as valid as time and outcome. The other thing this bill does that I think is important that we haven't gotten to in any of the bills is that in this bill we're actually trying to put some of the rubber on the road in the administrative process, where we're saying that even to become a continuing contract teacher, the administration, the superintendents, have to make sure that there is annual performance evaluations, and those are put into place. And so your districts out there, they have to hold the administrator's feet to the fire with this. And so I think that's important. That's the thing that is missing in the tenure bill, I think, is that the administrators, their feet are not held to the fire. In this particular bill, you begin to hold the administrator's feet to the fire. You're telling the bosses they've got to do their job. And frankly, I think if the bosses were doing their job right now, we wouldn't have a problem, that much of a problem, with the continuing contract. But then, again, I think there's some other problems with the people who defend the teachers, and in many cases, where it's black and white cases, and they've brought this problem on themselves, that they shouldn't be defending teachers when they shouldn't. So I think this really strikes the middle ground, holds the superintendents and the administrators their feet to the fire, and streamlines the appeal process. So I think in those two cases, it does a real good job.
Senator Rufo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The distinguished senator from Natrona County has identified that there is a problem with the process. But as I see it, the problem with the process is that it's an evidence-based process that doesn't generate sufficient evidence. So there really are two approaches to that. One is to stop it from being an evidence-based process, which we have a bill that effectively does, or this bill, which tries to generate the evidence. And I think that when we're trying to come up with the best solution, sticking with the evidence-based system, which is what we're trying to do here, but doing what's necessary to generate the sufficient evidence is really the objective that we have that provides the due process and make sure that the system is behaving as we want it to behave, but without undue burden, without undue difficulty that we could have, and with that due process in place. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of questions for the sponsor here that I'm a little confused on. My understanding, this tears off of SF-70. And based on the academic growth measures and the fact that SF-70 isn't even in place today, I like the concept. But we don't have a growth model right now. How are we going to evaluate? Now, what's the time frame for implementation here when we don't even have a growth model in place? I like the concept, but it sure seems to me that it's a little premature given the fact that a lot of the discussion that we just have revolved around the fact that what we're doing is charting a new course. We know that there may be some bumps in the road with that new course, but we're going to automatically right now tier to a substantial degree teacher performance on an annual evaluation on something that we haven't even tried to see if it's even effective at this point in time. So that's just kind of a question to see how you envision this being implemented over a period of time.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All good points. Starting with the last, if you look over on page 13, we're providing that other than subsection B, the act doesn't become effective till July 1st, 2012, so that gives at least a year. And we may have to, it may be that as the advisory committee comes into effect and the select committee, they're going to have to give us further recommendations. But we have at least a year to sort out these sorts of things. And I agree with you that we may find that if, for example, with probationary teachers, you're going to say, look, you have to show some growth in this, and some teachers are going to come in line right away. We'll accommodate that. We've got a year to sort those things out. And that's the purpose for the delayed enactment clause. With respect to the issue of the whether or not this bill is a misdiagnosis or the other bills that may be before us are misdiagnoses, I understand the argument, and I think the problem is, folks, you can make an equally eloquent argument with respect to both bills. And you can make the argument that eliminating tenure is a misdiagnosis. In fact, I make the point that if you want to say that a majority or 95% of your teachers are all good, so let's eliminate tenure because there's 5% out there that we want to go walk out tomorrow and fire. Well, a couple things wrong with that. One is this teaching profession is a decent paying career. It's not the best paying career. You could go into the oil and gas industry. You could do a lot of industries. You could go into be an accountant, a lawyer, and doctor and make a lot more money. And maybe even ranching this year. That's right. But you know, you do that. And, but part of what, as I've watched young people and kids that I think would be fantastic teachers go into these careers, and particularly kids that have the skill sets to do anything they want. You see kids that are top of their class. There are things that are attracted about being a teacher. You get your summers off. If you value your families and you want to spend your time with your families, it's a great career. But one of the things about doing is that, like anything else, as you move down your career path, and I know that all of you that have raised children know this, every time you're trying to advise your children to keep their options open, not to narrow their path, to make sure they can do an abundance of things. But the day you declare that education is your career path and you embark 4 years of education on there, you've eliminated your opportunity to go to medical school. You eliminated your opportunity to be an engineer. You eliminated you could probably do those things as long as you did a pre-med or pre-engineer or an engineering pathway. But for most folks, they've eliminated a lot of options. And they're entering into a government service contract where their life is going to be largely measured about how they get along with the principal and maybe their coworkers. And part of the tenure system that was designed is because it was implemented because they weren't getting good teachers. People didn't want to go to these careers. There was a reason we put into tenure. It wasn't because of unions. Unions didn't exist. It wasn't because of a variety of other reasons. It was there because we were losing good teachers and they were trying to attract good teachers. And if you misdiagnose this problem, you may find out that you don't have the best people going to teachers or going into this. The reason I chose law is because I get to walk into my office and nobody tells me what to do. And you probably realize that's a good career for me. But the good news is I recognized it early. And I honestly, when I see people go to a career where they're going to be subject to their teachers, the parents complaining about whether they ought to be a teacher at all, and they have all of these ups and downs, a very political process. An influential parent doesn't like the teacher, even though she's doing a good job, goes to the school board out to a cocktail dinner and saying, you need to fire that teacher. And if you want to say that all you have to do is make it easier for principals to select teachers out to fire them, frankly, you have a lot more confidence in principals than I do. Because the principals are oftentimes people, they're not your HR people that you see with Fortune 500 companies. These are people that might have been teachers that didn't enjoy teaching. They might be folks that are brand new, right out of college, have just gone through a master's in public administration type process with no HR skill sets. Oftentimes don't even have the skill sets that some of your master teachers and your instructional facilitators have. And they're out calling shots. And I've watched them come and go in my career, watching my spouse and other friends. And they're the last people often that I'd want to be deciding who gets fired and who doesn't. So ultimately, you want to make it a good career? Fair. Let's do that. Let's go together on it. You want accountability? Let's make accountability. But part of it is we're going to start holding principals and superintendents responsible, and that's how you do it. Frankly, at $1 billion, when you hear this nonsense about $100,000 being too much to fire a teacher, I say nonsense, because on a $1 billion budget, firing 10 or 15 teachers, and even if one, it didn't cost $150,000, that included, and we've known now, that includes fixed costs, cost of personnel, and things like that. It wasn't their out-of-pocket cost. But if your out-of-pocket cost is $50,000, compared to your personnel budget, that's minimal. Companies pay that much just to go through the civil rights issue that exists every time they want to fire a person that's of a protected class. And many of these teachers are going to be in protected classes. You're not going to solve that problem. And believe me, you are going to find that a lot of these teachers that need to go are teachers that are hanging on for their retirement. And the first thing that you're going to do is say, you go to fire them if they're an at-will employee, the first thing that's going to come up is age discrimination. And unless you have this kind of data, you're not going to be able to support your decision. I think misdiagnosis is an appropriate discussion for both bills. And I urge you to support this bill.
Senator Bevatt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And those are all really good arguments my colleague from Albany County makes, and that's why it's a practice of law, and he chose that career, and he's obviously pretty good at it. I took engineering because it's numbers. And the one thing that I can't get a handle on, and maybe someone can answer this question, and it's about how you choose a career versus a tenured situation versus a salary situation, and the amount of money that you're paid for that particular career. And if there's some kind of statistic out there that show that people will choose tenure over a substantial salary differential or something like that, that certainly would help me in making the decision, and at least in my life, and of course that doesn't mean it's right for sure. When I looked at jobs, I didn't think about being tenured. And I understand the private sector is different than teachers, and I've made those comments before and before, the importance of teaching. But it was more the salary, the job, those kinds of things, and tenure wasn't part of it. So maybe there's some information out there that would at least help this senator in this kind of discussion.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I remain concerned about the process in this bill. It was said the OIH does a good job in workers' comp. And workers' comp, you've got a much simpler fact situation, I think. Usually the question, the overwhelming majority of cases they get, is was the injury work-related? And I think typically that's much easier to prove one way or the other. Having said that, we're seeing a fair amount of evidence that we're getting a problem in workers' comp with people using workers' comp for health insurance, meaning that it's covering a bunch of things that are not work-related. So I'm not as confident as might be that that process works well. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think maybe this bill, I think the bill may be premature until we get the growth assessments working properly. But I think we need to work on the process. Maybe the one that was in the bill the other day that didn't involve a hearing, that was the streamlined process, independent of whether they're at will or not. Maybe that process would be a useful one to bring in here. But I don't think we've got the process problem solved here, because I think they're still going to be so burdensome that you'll find they aren't used though.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I hear what my colleague from Natrona County is saying. I think if you look at the criteria in the hearings that are envisioned in this bill, they are much different than workers' comp. We know those hearings involve levels of disability and compensation. But what this bill in essence says is if a supervisor, which are it's the building principals or assistant principals in big schools such as the county to the south of where I am, it says that principal's got a document, and it's a pretty straightforward list. And what's been added, physical incapacity, well, we kind of know what that is, failure to perform duties in a satisfactory manner. All that principal's got to do is say, you know, the teacher didn't show up for work. I think that would be one of the things. The teacher went to the wrong classroom and taught the fifth grade instead of the third grade, and document that and say they didn't get the job done. Those are not really high bars. Those are pretty easy to do. Document inadequate performance, and I'm on line 17. And we understand that there's the delay till we can get the performance evaluation tied to growth. But documenting the performance. And then the real kicker is down on lines 22 and 23. Any other good or just cause relating to the educational process. But the bottom line to this is it requires a principal or an assistant principal, depending on the size of your school, and understand in some areas it's going to be the superintendent, because they're the really small school districts, have to go in and be in a classroom. And that may make some of them nervous, but it's probably really good for them. Again, going back to the case that's often cited, that seems to be the bellwether case, and was really expensive, I urge you go read that case. You will be surprised at where the snafu came. But again, what this envisions is principals doing their job. The building principal getting out of the hallway during recess and actually going into a classroom and taking notes, maybe. That's all it takes. And you can fire teachers on the basis of those notes. Our school board has done it very successfully. And what happens is when you bring the notes in, document it, it doesn't go to a hearing. It's a done deal, because you've documented the shortcomings of that teacher, and it's done. I think this is a good idea. I think it's a good compromise. I urge support of the bill.
Senator Estabell.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief. I've been staring at the paragraph on page 12, lines 2 to line 5. And on that paragraph, on line 5, it says that school districts have described this process as complex, time-consuming, and legally challenging. And like I said, I've been staring at that paragraph, because it seems to me that what they're saying is that they want something simple, something quick, and something that doesn't take something legally unchallenged. And, you know, it seemed to me that We do want a process that has some complexity to it, that it does take time, and that you do have some legal principles on which you're relying on, because we're dealing with someone's livelihood, we're doing with, as the good senator from Albany County mentioned, you know, someone that we've invested a lot of money in through high school and college and certificates. So it seems to me that, you know, one of the things that that we have to be cognizant of is that, you know, we do want to have some barriers that have to be crossed in order to terminate someone from their position. And in this case, it seems like from the numbers, we're not talking about a whole lot of numbers, although the way the conversation has been going, it seems like we've been invaded by hundreds of underperforming teachers in our state. You know, so I'm glad that the good senator from Albany County mentioned that it's only a very, very small percentage, because from our talk, sometimes it seems just the opposite. So anyway, I just throw those thoughts out for the body to consider. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dr. Statter.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief. We've worked this over quite a bit here this afternoon, but I would submit to you that this is not premature legislation. This is well put together. It fits with our overall picture of what we're trying to accomplish here. It involves the administrators. This is a good fit with our overall efforts here. On it for the bill.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, at the risk of standing up late in the program as a freshman, I just wanted to say a couple things, and I've heard several times that we've described the system as broken, and I'd suggest to you that it may not be producing the level of results that some people want at different times, but in looking at the students that are coming out and the good teachers that are putting their work into the process, I'm not sure that I could call it broken. I'm in defense of this system. It is working. We have some amazing product coming out of our schools, if you can call kids product. They're doing a great job at this. Can we tune it? Absolutely. I think this bill goes a long way in helping set that language. Just today in the conversation, we've heard a number of different questions that can be addressed through amendments, and I'd encourage us to move this forward.
Question is, all those in favor of Senator Cole's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 146, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Next bill for consideration is Senate File 105. Reading clerk will please read the file.
Senate File 105, State Control of Certain Lands, an Act Relating to Public Land, sponsored by Senator Jennings. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss, Senator Bebout. Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move in the Committee of the Whole rising report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 105, State Control of Certain Land, do pass. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that be read in at this time.
Reading clerk, read in the amendment, please.
Senate File 105, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 2.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 105, and I will turn it over to explain the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill to the bill sponsor, Senator Jennings.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I promise I won't say teacher in this one. Mr. Chairman, if you find yourself late at night and not a lot to do, and there's nothing good on TV, try reading the statutes, and you might find something hidden in the statutes, like 3612101, State Control of Certain Lands. Mr. Chairman, this statute that we have right now, it's already there, has some legislative determinations It says the intent of the framers of the Constitution of the United States was to guarantee to each of the states sovereignty over all matters within its boundaries, except for those powers specifically granted to the United States as agents of the states. And, Mr. Chairman, it goes on to talk about how the land that was not titled when we became a state automatically went to the United States government. And, Mr. Chairman, back then, that was how the U.S. government funded itself. It had these lands, and it would dispose of them. So the deal was, everything that wasn't titled in Wyoming, you get. And at that time, that was a lot of land, and we know, because a lot of it's left. But they agreed that they would sell it off and dispose of it. Even in our state constitution, there's a piece there that says, if there's any arid land that can be irrigated, the state gets it. And so there was a provision there to get it back. Well, Mr. Chairman, as time went on, we started to realize that we didn't come in on equal footing on that deal, because the same deal wasn't put out to all the other states. And so there were some conditions there that says that we should have been on the same equal footing. And Mr. Chairman, so what happened about almost 30 years ago was this body right here, made up of a whole bunch of different members. I don't know if maybe one of them was here, but anyway, this body and the governor and the other side all decided that what we needed to do is we needed to figure out how to tell the federal government we wanted our land back. So in statute, again, both houses, governor signs it, it says that we are to, that the Board of Land Commissioners, now Land Board, shall develop a plan for the transfer and management of lands and minerals subject to this act. That's those lands that the federal government took when we became a state. And, Mr. Chairman, I really looked hard, and I can't find that report because it was never done. This has been sitting in statute for 30 years. There was obviously good intent behind it. There was obviously research completed on this, and it was obviously important enough that it went through our legislature, was signed by the governor, and Mr. Chairman, there's been, what, 5 administrations since then that has let it sit there. So, Mr. Chairman, I got a little intrigued about what was going on here. So I went back and I started to dig a little deeper, and I found some people that were around when this became law. And, Mr. Chairman, what this is a piece of legislation was developed out of what we know as the Sagebrush Rebellion. And what these people did in the western states is they went back and they found bits and pieces of our history and documentation in our history and started to build a case that maybe we did come in on uneven footing. Now, Mr. Chairman, what's happened since then is kind of interesting, too, because we came up with the Federal Land Management Act. And what we did there was the federal government decided we're done disposing of land, because we have this new thing called tax, and we just make our money off of tax. We don't have to sell the land to pay for the armies and the ports and all that kind of stuff. So there's a second level where it kind of looks like they broke the deal, because the deal was, we'll give you all this dirt, but you've got to dispose of it so that you can pay for your expenses and the president's salary and all that kind of stuff. So we have another level there that we've kind of wandered off, and they're not keeping the deal. So, Mr. Chairman, what I decided to try to do is really kind of simple. It's like, let's just update this. Let's just go back and take a look at this and see what was going on, and was there really a reason to do this? Because if there wasn't a reason to do it, we should have gone back and taken it out of some of that archaic language that's not doing anything. But, Mr. Chairman, we haven't done that in the last 28 years. And as you see on this handout right here, that is your statute. So it's all there, and you can see what they were saying back there. You can see that the report was due January 1, 1983. It didn't happen. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll address the amendment now and kind of show you what we worked out in committee to try to walk through this. As you notice on the first page, line two, we struck the, you know, originally I thought we should put this in the Office of State Lands Investment. And really, a good chairman pointed out it really belongs with the Wyoming Attorney General. And so, Mr. Chairman, as you go through to page two, you notice that we'll add the Wyoming Attorney General there. And then we add, after act, you know, shall develop a plan for the transfer management of lands and minerals subject to the act, which is current statute. We add, the plan shall be developed in phases, and the first phase shall explore and report on the legal feasibility of developing the plan and shall identify persons or entities that may have research or other data that can assist developing the plan. And this plan, back to language in the statute, this plan will be submitted to the governor and the legislature prior to January, and it was 1983, we updated that to 2012, and will be subject to their approval. So, Mr. Chairman, what we're doing here is we're going to just go back and look. We're going to take some time, kind of sort through this, maybe bring some of these guys that had the original data, and we actually found some of these people that are willing to come in, put their time in here. There's some think tanks out there that have also been working on this ideas for the last 30 years. So this plan would tell the AG's office to go and look at it. Actually, got to spend some time with the Attorney General that would be assigned to this, and one of the first things out of her mouth when we sat down to talk about it was she said, this is one of the first statutes that I found that we weren't doing anything about. And she said, and that was several years ago, she was kind of tickled that we're picking this up and looking at it. So, Mr. Chairman, continuing on the amendment, we struck such a plan shall consider, and then put in, if the first phase is approved by the governor and legislature, the plan shall be further developed to complete an inventory of lands affected within Wyoming and to propose a timeline for the enactment of the plan. This portion of the plan shall be submitted to the governor and the legislature no more than 1 year after the approval of the first phase. If approved by the governor and the legislature, the plan shall be submitted to the governor and legislature for final approval. And then, Mr. Chairman, we went on, and on Section C, there was, in current statute, any person who attempts to exercise jurisdiction over land secured under this act in a manner not permitted by the laws of the state is guilty of a felony punished by imprisonment for not less than 2 years or more than 10 years. And so added on that, might as well throw some money into that fine, so added on that a fine of not more than $10,000. Now, Mr. Chairman, in talking to some of the people that were here and helping develop this, one of the big things that they had on their mind was that we, as we became a state, we had two sovereign units. We had the United States of America, and we had the state of Wyoming. And so as two sovereign units, they felt that the only place that you could really go in court, and there probably would be some court time on this, was the U.S. Supreme Court. So for the benefit of those people, I put in that the Supreme Court was the jurisdiction for this. But in committee, we decided that we could probably tell the Supreme Court whatever we wanted, and they wouldn't listen to us. So we went ahead and took that part out. Mr. Chairman, as we go back through the bill, you notice that we've updated the dates to 2012, and there's some areas in the definitions that will not be affected by this, and it's one of them is land that was title was held in the state or a municipality in the state before March 1st, and we updated that to 2012, or which was controlled by the United States Department of Defense on March 1st, 2012. You know, I really don't think if we went over and told them we wanted the Air Force base, they'd give it to us. So, I mean, whatever you have for the military, we really want them there anyway. And then the last one changed, Mr. Chairman, was in four, and we added the current language was which was a national park, national monument, land in trust for Indians, wildlife refuge, or wilderness area established prior to January 1, 2012. We added in there, Mr. Chairman, which was a congressionally designated. And the reason that we put that in there, Mr. Chairman, was currently we have this thing out there called wildlands coming out of the Interior Department, and that's not congressionally designated. That's coming out of rules or somebody in there that the Interior that thinks that they can go out there and rename our land and then put it in the queue to become wilderness, I guess, and do whatever they want with it. So, Mr. Chairman, the first there is the amendment, and I think I've walked through it, so I would ask that we vote aye on the amendment, and I'd stand for questions.
Question on the amendment, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Question being called for. All in favor of Senator Demout's motion that we adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 105, say aye. Those opposed, no. Motion passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, when the original law was put on the books, and the reason nothing has been done about it was that original bill was a bad bill. It's not practical. It's not constitutional. It was a bad bill, and I voted against it then. And I did. Now, having said that, Mr. Chairman, I think they may be getting somewhere with the Standing Committee Amendment we just adopted, because there may be a plan that might work. The problem we're having with the feds is that they are so restrictive as to what can be done in the land. The plan that might work, and it would take the right kind of receptivity in Washington, D.C. What would happen if we promised to buy the land and give them the same share they're now getting on particularly the mineral income, which is what really counts here, so that their cash flow doesn't change, but they get rid of all the responsibilities of administering it and all those federal laws that complicate that. We promise to keep it public land. We promise to maintain public access to it, which is important. But if we own it, we can administer it according to our own law. And we can get rid of all the Mickey Mouse that impedes the ability to use that land effectively to meet the needs that this country and this state has. Now, Washington might not go for it, but if you promise them the same revenue stream, then you might have something. So I think with a little modification that maybe we can turn this into something that's at least worth making an offer to them and see if we can get anywhere. Because law stands now in our books. It's no good and ineffective, and that's why nothing's been done.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, well, I'm happy to see that there's hope for my colleague. One of the in the determinations, one of the things is it says is the exercise of that domain and control of the public land in the state of Wyoming by the United States works a severe, continuous, and debilitating hardship upon the people of the state of Wyoming. Mr. Chairman, that was 30 years ago. Well, my colleague from Natrona County has pointed out is it's only gotten worse. If you go down and under the management, you look at what we're supposed to look at, we're supposed to establish concepts for multiple use, sustained yield, which will permit the development of and uses for agriculture, grazing, recreation, minerals, timber, and the development, production, and transmission of energy and other public utility services. It shall be managed in such a manner as to permit the conservation and protection of watersheds, wildlife habitat, and historic, scenic, fish and wildlife, recreational, and natural values. Mr. Chairman, this is what we're fighting today. And all we're asking with this bill, and you notice there's not an appropriation on this, went to the AG's office, and they said, we're here, we can do this. So all we're asking with this bill is let's do plan one, or the first phase of this plan. Let's go out, take a look, see if there's anything that's developed. What we're going to do is take the time to prove whether this is was a bad bill back when it was passed, when my colleague voted against it, see if it was a good bill, or see if things have changed enough to maybe we better take a look at this and see what we can do. We come back here in a year, and we listen to the plan. If it says we're all crazy, then we drop it.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, and I did notice there was no appropriation on this. The and I see that the fiscal note on page on the final page says that there is a fiscal impact to the Office of State Lands and Investment, not the Attorney General's office. And I see that there is a SLIB board requirement. And simply the process of going out and inventorying all the federal lands, and this is a pretty extraordinary task, I would assume. So I guess my question is there a fiscal note returned from the SLIB office? And I'd have a hard time believing that if they have the capacity to do this, then maybe we ought to eliminate a position. The and then I guess the other aspect is if we do think that it's worthwhile to dedicate an employee to devising this plan. It's been since 1980s, the Sagebrush Rebellion was out there. Have other states prepared these plans? Has any one state prepared? Has anybody had any success at it to justify the plan? I see that you're ceding jurisdiction to the United States Supreme Court. I'm not sure that we have any capacity to provide jurisdiction to a court that's not under our power or jurisdiction. But to begin with, is if there's no fiscal impact and we can be assured of it and it's chicken soup, then fine. But if I guess we need to find out.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Went down, first of all, the appropriation or the fiscal impact that was on the bill, that was when we were going to put it over into the State Lands Department. We kind of rattled their cage a little bit. Wasn't their thing. What their fiscal note was to go out and hire consultants in these three different areas and do the inventory and all that kind of stuff. Remember, look at the bill, the way it's phrased now with the amendment on there. We're not going to inventory the land. All we're going to do in the first phase is determine whether or not there is a route. Take the research that these other people have, the people that were there when the bill was first established, and just simply look at it and say, is there a way to do that or not? If it's not, then we have the report in 2012, and that's it. As far as other states, what I got talking to the people that were in the Sagebrush Rebellion back then, and the other states that did this, they said there was a real push, a subtle push from the federal government, and all of a sudden everybody just kind of dropped off. Now, it may be because it wasn't a good thing. But all I'm asking with this bill is take some time out of the AG's schedule. I've talked to them. They didn't come back with any. I mean, we pushed this bill back until today, waiting for them, and they didn't come back with anything that was going to cost them money. So they obviously are going to do this under their current budget. I guess it's time that that person was already going to be there, and the person assigned to it right now seems kind of excited about it.
You ready for the question on Senate File 105? All those in favor of Senator Bebout motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 105. Say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Chairs in doubt, all in favor, please rise. Those opposed, please rise. Senate File 105 have passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that this Committee of the Whole stand at ease for a short break for staff.
Committee of the Whole is standing at ease. Senate Committee of the Whole will come back to order. Make them hurry. Next bill for consideration is Senate File 145. Reading clerk will please read it. Oh, excuse me, Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of order. Members of the Senate, our rules require that when you're on the floor in general file, you must vote. And it's not appropriate not to vote. In the last vote that we have, there are some that did not vote. You're required to vote, so that's just an admonition.
Reading clerk, read Senate File 145.
Senate File 145, Medicaid Fraud Recovery, an act relating to Medicaid, sponsored by Senator Peterson. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Nutting, Schiffer, and Scott, excuse Senator Martin, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 145 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 145, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 23.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment is a bit extensive, but it is relatively simple to understand. What's going on here, this whole bill relates to Medicaid fraud, and there is a federal enactment, part of a Deficit Reduction Act, that has a federal law, and what it provides, you see, when we recover a Medicaid fraud, the feds get part of the take, and we get part of the take, and the federal law provides that we get an additional 10 percentage points worth if we have a fraud recovery law that conforms to theirs and conforms to the regulations they have under theirs. And what happened was the bill as introduced was drafted with some language in it that doesn't comply with the federal, I think because it was on a somewhat earlier version of things, and we've gradually learned over time what language we have to have in to conform to the feds and what we don't. And there was an extensive set of amendments prepared, actually by the drug industry lobbying group. And one of the things those amendments did was to bring us into conformance with the federal act. And what the committee did was we went through the draft amendments with the assistance of the lady that runs our Medicaid fraud recovery program, and we adopted the ones that bring us into conformance with the federal act, and we did not adopt those that made the process easier on the pharmaceutical industry. So the ones you see here are the ones that bring us into conformity with the federal act. Now, Mr. Chairman, that's a little bit of a mixed bag because we get 10 percentage points extra, but we also get assessed some of the costs involved in getting those recoveries. So we don't get a full 10 percentage points, but it will be a net positive benefit for us. Mr. Chairman, that's a very simple explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment, and if there are questions, I'll yield to either the sponsor or another member of the committee to explain them further.
Questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Ready for the question? All in favor of Senator Scott's motion that we adopt Senate Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 145, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would yield to Senator Peterson, sponsor of the bill.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope the rest of it goes that easy. It's a simple little bill. One that came to my attention as I serve on your Appropriations Committee, and I was concerned last session about the deep, dark hole that we have when it comes to Medicaid and our costs as a state. The good chairman explained a little bit about the dilemma that we have and the fact that we participate 50% of our Medicare, our Medicaid costs with the federal partners, and they pretty much dictate the rules and regulations and pretty much control the gate, which allows those that apply to be qualified and receive those benefits. This is a safety net for our citizens of our great state, and it is estimated that nearly 10% or more is those claims that are made fraudulently, and so I was alerted to this fact, asked the question to one of our good departments that handles this portion of our state budget of what we were doing as a state to enforce our Medicaid fraud area. And I didn't receive the answer that I wanted. It was an answer that I was quite disappointed in, quite frankly, in the fact that we depend a lot on our doctors if there's suspected Medicaid fraud going on. Now, if you're like me, Mr. Chairman, fellow senators, that hit me right between the eyes. I wanted to follow up with the question, and how's that working out for us? Because it's not. And so I started to pursue it a little further. As I came down to this session, committed myself to follow up and see what other states were doing about Medicaid fraud, these claims that are coming in, and how we can maybe do a better job of enforcing these laws and putting a little teeth, I guess, into our bark and our bite. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just run through the bill and try to cover it as quickly as I can, considering the time that we've got. Basically, what this bill does is create a Wyoming Medicaid False Claims Act. As the good chairman is explaining, this will make it compliant with the DRA requirements that our federal partners have. Basically, what that means is they want to know if we're serious about Medicaid fraud and doing our portion or our part. And so our statutes need to be revised somewhat in order to be in conformance. It authorizes civil recoveries for the state and the persons reporting false claims. This would be what we refer to as the whistleblower section or the relators section. It also prescribes duties of the Attorney General's office, providing procedures and providing for a limitations period. And that basically is what this bill tries to do. I'll explain as we work through the bill, as we talked about basically the Deficit Reduction Act, that's the DRA, and also the False Claims Act, the FCA. Section 424302 are the definitions. They are exactly the same definitions that appear in the federal version. So that takes care of our definition section of the bill. Section 424303, that's page 5, line 7. This is a person who violates this statute is liable to the state for these three items. 3 times the amount of damages. 2, costs of civil action. That's on line 14. And on line 17, it specifies $5,000 or $10,000, no more than $10,000 for each violation. On page 7, line 18, that's the 3 times the amount of damages. On line or page 7, line 18, we talk about the 2 times the amount of damages and no civil penalty if the person self-reports, fully cooperates, and no other legal action is pending regarding the violation. So we try to define how cooperative the person is in working through this process if they're found to be in violation. Violations include the following. On page 5, line 22, they knowingly present a claim for payment to the state that is false. Knowingly creates or uses a record that is false and is material to a false claim for payment. That is found on page 6, line 2. On that same page, line 6, conspires with someone to commit a violation of this act. Same page, line 13. Has possession or control of money or property belonging to the state and delivers less than all of it. Same page, line 19. We're still talking about the violations. Line 19, delivers a document or receipt of state property without knowledge of its truth while intending to defraud the state. On the next page, page 7, line 1, knowingly receives property from an officer of the state, knowing the officer does not have the authority to do so. Or, line 5, knowingly makes or uses a false record material to a debt owed to the state, or knowingly conceals or decreases a debt owed to the state. Those are the violations that we would like to go after. On page 8, line 16, we go into 42-4-304. This sets out the duties of our Attorney General's office, allowing the whistleblower or the relator of the plaintiff to file on behalf of the state. Options for the AG once filed, recovery available to the relator, and retaliation protections against the relator. On line 21 of page 8, this is what the AG will do. Shall diligently investigate alleged violations. Line 24, shall have the ability to conduct pre-filing discovery. And then on page 9, line 3, may bring a civil action, file an FCA case in court. So that's the AG's responsibilities. We try to lay out the responsibilities of the relator or the whistleblower. Page 9, line 10. They may file a civil action for violation of this statute in the name of the state. The case is filed confidentially with the court and remains under seal for at least 60 days. The defendant is not served with the complaint until released from seal by the court. Also, the relator shall serve the complaint on the AG's office. Filing under seal allows the Attorney General's office to investigate and determine whether to pursue or not. And so in this whole section, fellow senators, we're trying to, of course, give the state basically an out if they feel that the case is not worthwhile or not worth pursuing. Does this stop the relator from pursuing it on their own? Certainly not. The relator can pursue and be reimbursed for their costs if the claim is found to be worthy and judgment is made. Moving on. The Attorney General's options after filing a by relator in that same section. The AG's office may proceed with the case, then become the state's case and not dependent on the relator's case. If the state proceeds, the state or defendant may limit the relator's participation. That's an important part. Sometimes we have a relator that works well with the state, and other times not. The state or defendant may limit the relator's participation. The AG's office may move to dismiss. The AG's office may settle the case. They may pursue through alternate remedy, administrative action, or so on. Or finally, to decline the case, the relator must then continue on their own. The state may choose to intervene at a later date. So again, another out for the state if they wanted to pursue that at a later date. There, in this same section, in 42.4.304, we also go into what the relator, their proceeds, depending on what findings are found by this by the claim. 15% to 25%, depending on the relator's contribution, if the state proceeds with the case. This is, again, talking about the 10% bump that we get if our statutes are in compliance or found to be compliant with our federal partners. A lot of the concern and the heartburn was then we're giving a lot of that back or more to the relators. What we have found out through testimony that most of our cases in the state of Wyoming will not be on a personal type basis. Let's say the people that are receiving basically the services of through Medicaid. What we find out is a lot of these are going to be directed towards providers. These are doctors, dentists, nursing homes, hospitals, records that possibly have been falsified knowingly or unknowingly. And we want to start to through this bill, get serious about some of the things that we want to pursue here as a state as far as enforcement of Medicaid fraud. Page 19, line 19, section 42.4305, statute of limitations or the burden of proof, we address that. Any action may not be brought more than 6 years after the violation was committed. And then finally, the last page, criminal statute revisions. This is where we try to put teeth into the act. Page 22, let me review this first under definitions. This is important. Page 22 of the bill. Intentional means that a person with respect to information intended to act in violation of the law. Line 10, knowing or knowingly includes intentional or unintentionally and means that a person with respect to information acts, A, with actual knowledge of the information, B, in deliberate ignorance of the truth or falsity of the information, or C, in reckless disregard of the truth or falsity of the information. That's pretty strong. And in a lot of our cases in our particular state and other states, most of the defendants, when called on the carpet, you might say, claim of not being knowledgeable, of not knowing. We tried to allow some leeway in this bill, in this proposed statute, to allow our Attorney General to make those calls. And the main thing that we're trying to do is educate and enforce and to try to protect this money that has been provided as a safety net for those people who need it. And if there is fraud going on, and I would suspect there is, if we're like other states, about 10% or more, then we need to protect that amount and make sure it gets to the right people that are deserving of it. The last page includes the teeth that I've been referring to. On line 2, a person who fails to maintain records in accordance with Medicaid program rules and requirements for medical assistance is guilty of, little I, a felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine of not more than $10,000 or both if the value of related medical assistance is $1,000 or more. And two, a misdemeanor punishable by imprisonment for not more than 6 months, a fine of not more than $750 or both if the value of related medical assistance is less than $1,000. And that is the bill in its entirety, Mr. Chairman. And basically, what we're after with this bill, Mr. Chairman, is, as I have mentioned, to get a little stiffer in our penalties, to be the watchdog of these funds that I feel are somewhat sacred and meant for the use of these individuals that are deserving of these funds. And if we don't do this, then we just allow those funds to be, stepped on, abused. And so I guess the feds are asking the states to do their part. I would guess probably about 25 states have done this. Have conformed to the federal requirements in their statutes and have gone after and I guess, in a nutshell, done their part in trying to enforce this Medicaid fraud, this False Claims Act. And I guess I was, just a personal note, Mr. Chairman, you know, I myself was involved in a government program years ago trying to get into my first home. It was a great program. It got young married couples into a home without any collateral or any type of money at all, and this was a great program. You were limited. You had a number of square footage that you could have in your home, build your home for, and it did. It got us into a home, but it was a miserable program. You had an annual audit. You had to go and lay out everything. You had to prove that you could still qualify. It was so miserable. I told my wife, I said, I can't wait to get out from underneath this, and it worked. That was the intent of the program. Got us into a home, and in 3 years, we were at a commercial loan as fast as we could possibly get there. And I look at these government programs, such as Medicaid, and I feel that we have a responsibility here to make sure that Medicaid is kept to be a program that is hard to apply for, hard to get. That's the gate. This is one of the only controls that we have. In controlling the Medicaid in our state is to make sure that the money gets to the people that are deserving of it and that truly need it. And I would ask for your favorable consideration on Senate File 145.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, this is bill is not the... I guess what I'm trying to say is I have mixed feelings about this bill. And I will confess, Mr. Chairman, that the day the committee took most of the testimony, I was locked up in Appropriations Committee and couldn't attend and hear and pay attention to what was going on in my own committee. That's a problem we've got in our system. We've got a major problem here, and we need to do something about it. The best evidence I've seen is that the fraud rate in the, not this program, but the Medicare program, is 10% of the total. That's an awful lot of money. I think there's reason to believe that the Medicaid fraud rate is probably at about the same level. So it's a major problem. But there's some problems with the approach here. One is that you're mirroring federal legislation, and they tend to be poorly written. And there's some rather strange provisions. I call your attention to the provision on page 3, lines 14 through 16, where they define knowing and knowingly, and it's with respect to information and without, and with or without specific intent to defraud. And then look how that definition is used over on page 5, where one of the things that's a civil penalty is knowingly presents or causes to be presented to any employee to, actually we struck that, knowingly presents or caused to be presented a false or fraudulent claim for payment of approval. And here we've defined knowingly as with or without intent to commit fraud. I have some reservations about that, but that's part of the federal thing. You have some of the same on the next page. The Standing Committee removed some, but not all of that. And then, basically, the philosophy here is that we're going to turn a bunch of individuals and a bunch of trial lawyers loose on the Medicaid program, and if they can uncover something, we'll let them recover treble damages, civil damages. And is that the best way to go? Maybe a better way. Then it may well be a better way than hiring a big bureaucracy to go pursue these and do audits. I don't know. So I call the Senate's attention to it that this is not a simple thing. The pharmaceutical industry, Mr. Chairman, flew out experts to testify on this from back east. That's spending a lot of money. There's something here they don't like. I don't think they were just, we used them to get us in compliance with the Federal Act, but I think there was more at stake than that. But the rules on drug pricing are fearful and wonderful in Medicaid. For example, there's a federal prohibition on our program telling us how much specific drugs cost in the Medicaid program. They keep it secret. Incredible. So you've got a whole series of cross currents. I think it's a subject we need to proceed on. I think we need to find some ways to get at it because I think it's costing us a lot of money. But I do urge the Senate to take a hard look at this bill. It takes us down a particular route with some particular language from the feds that is kind of strange.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is serious, and it's serious language. For those of you that don't serve on appropriations, these numbers I'm sure you might be familiar with. We are on appropriations. But the first 6 months of our biennium, we were $20 million down. Our estimates for Medicaid, our burn rate for Medicaid was here. Our actual spending or appropriations were here, $20 million above. If that rate continues, we'll be nearly $100 million over budget with Medicaid. Our agency that handles Medicaid, $1.6 billion is their biennial budget. Out of that $1.6 billion, $1.2 billion is Medicaid expenditures. It's a big problem. This is an important bill. I'd urge your support.
Senator Emmerich.
Two things come to my mind, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. On page 9 of the bill, section B, a person may bring a civil suit for a violation of this act for the person and for the state in the name of the state subject to the following. This brings to mind the TV ads. Have you been injured? Call the strong arm. In the next paragraph, Romanet I, the person bringing the action shall be referred to as the ketam. Now, I remember enough Latin. I can't give you the whole term, but it means he who sues for the king sues for himself. This kind of is self-serving. I'd just like to have a little explanation, if I might, please.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with the sponsors of this bill that this is serious stuff. This is big bucks. And there's no reason to expect that we have fewer fraudulent claims in this state than any other state. And I'm no good at math, but you can figure what 10% of $1.3 billion is. And answer, Mr. Chairman, was gone the day we heard this. Part of the testimony that we heard is the most often when a person is accused of being fraudulent, the pat answer is, gee, I didn't know I was supposed to keep records. That's why this knowing or knowingly is in there. They just say, nope, there's no records. And with no records, there's no case. The testimony both from, and understand, this amendment was one of the ones proposed by the pharmaceutical industry, and it was also concurred with by the state attorney general as being necessary if we're going to be successful in curbing the fraudulent cases. In answer to the colleague on page 9, and I believe his Latin is great. I mean, I'm impressed. That's, but understand, and I'd reply in Latin, but I don't know any, other than Weeny Weedy Wiki or something. We did address what I think is your concern in the standing committee amendment. It's down on the bottom of page 1. To the standing committee, in the standing committee amendment, where we say, relator is such an undignified word, whistleblower is really much, there's glory in that, I think, I don't know. But if a whistleblower brings an action, the state, if the court and our attorney general, we can say, well, wait a minute, we're going down the wrong road. We're pulling out of this. In other words, they can go on about their business, but in terms of the state's participation, we still maintain our supremacy or our ability to go in or go out. And I think that's the protection that we need. We amended that in to make sure that a whistleblower wasn't driving the train. They were just operating the whistle. But we had the hand on the throttle.
Senator Rufus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for the sponsor, actually, on page 23, which is the area of the bill where it adds some punishments, felonies and misdemeanors. I was curious whether that was structured based on the federal law, with the specific dollar amounts, the fines, and the level of punishment, or whether that was something that was subject to some interpretation or amendment. It seems that $1,000 line, I would sure hate to be the person who hit 1,001, for example. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate clarification on that.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, is my understanding that the provisions on pension plan provisions are not federal funds, they're state funds, and we can exercise on federal benefits?
Further question, Senator Nettie?
The Medicaid fraud often is dependent on a whistleblower, and a lot of the cases have come up only because there was a whistleblower and they would not have been found out otherwise. In the past, whistleblowers, to use that term, have been treated rather harshly and often at expense and loss of a job to themselves. So I think they need the protection that is in this bill as well as the stimulus to come forward.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we drafted this bill, we took it off of a model that was somewhat outdated, 2005, 2006, somewhere in that date. As we went through the process and took other states, what they were doing, the other states that have already made improvements to their statutes to conform with this DRA compliance, a lot of those states had these same, the last page that we were referring to, the questions, you might say the teeth, a lot of the states have done the same thing. And so that's where those ideas came from. The necessity for the whistleblowers are AG's office, the Medicaid division or fraud division consists of four. An attorney, the director, an investigator, an office manager, and a clerk. And so with an office of staff of four and a population of 500,000 in a big state with all those miles, I think whistleblowers is a necessity in our state. And remember that just because a whistleblower files a grievance or a complaint or turning somebody in doesn't necessarily mean the state has to take it. I think people can be our ears and eyes out there. I think we need to do something to reverse the trend. The trend is what scares me. I don't see it getting any better. And I think if people knew that there were laws in our state with teeth and eyes and ears around them, that maybe, perhaps, they'd just be a little bit more law-abiding and being truthful in filling out those forms. My last comment, any government program, make no mistake, the government program that I was involved in to get into my first home as a home buyer, I knew every rule, backwards and forwards. They were explained to me. And so ignorance is just no excuse. Government, if we want to play the government game and apply for government funds, then we better play by the government's rules. And that's all this states. These are the rules. Play by them.
Question being called for. All in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 145, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senate File 145 have passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is Senate File 150. Reading clerk will please read it.
Senate File 150, Notaries, an Act Relating to Notaries, sponsored by Senator Nicholas. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivision. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President, thank you. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 150, Notaries. And I'd also, there's a standing committee amendment, Mr. President. I'd like it read in at this time.
Senate File 150, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 17, line 3.
Thank you. Mr. President, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 150. And for an explanation of this bill and the fine Standing Committee Amendment, I would yield to the good senator from Albany County who did a wonderful job explaining this to the committee. Oh, wait. I don't think he was there. This should be good.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I was with the good senator from Natrona County in an Appropriations Committee hearing, so the good news is your bills got out. And had I been there, I think I would have pointed out that it is actually, by statute, the ex officio registrar of deeds. So I probably opposed their committee meeting. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this bill, the principal reason I brought this bill is over on pages 32 through 34. And the reason for this is that several years ago, the bill was brought through the legislative process without an interim process, and inadvertently, without making any accommodation for a change, the bill, which intended to conform it to the CUSL National Uniform State Law Commission statutes, dropped out what we called before the Uniform Acknowledgement Act. And where I, on a couple occasions when we were doing litigation with respect to undue influence, and what happens in undue influence, first thing somebody says is that when they sign the deed or they sign the instrument, that the person either wasn't there or that he didn't have the property capacity. And what the Uniform Acknowledgement Act used to say is that when you notarize an instrument, there's a presumption that you were there, that he was in presence, and that he was had, in most instances, if it's an acknowledgement, signed it under his free will, under free will without any undue influence. And we had actually eliminated those statutes. And so what ends up happening is you have a notary public and a notary, whether it's an acknowledgement or a jurat is an oath. Acknowledgement says that you came before the notary. He looked at your driver's license if he doesn't know you or he knows you, and it was your free act under no undue influence. Well, the statutes say the other thing that happens, frankly, is we use what's called a short form. We don't use the long notarial forms that we used to use at the beginning of my career that says the person appeared, he's under no undue influence, and about two paragraphs long worth of information. Rather, we simply say the person came before me and this was acknowledged to me in my presence. So when you have those short forms, the issue is what does it mean without a presumption? So this brings back that presumptive language, which will avoid some litigation in the future. The rest of the bill is brought with my co-sponsor to update the Notaries Act. There's a whole industry on notaries, and they apparently would rather prefer to be called the notarial officers instead of a notary. Seems kind of odd to me since notarial is an adjective and notaries is a noun, but that's the way they are. That's where the Uniform Act goes. So the Act brings in to and codifies some practices, frankly, that are rarely seen in Wyoming, but I think if you find on occasion you're trying to conduct or if you're trying to certify certain documents, it provides some opportunities to do things that, frankly, we don't do here much. So a lot of it, Mr. Chairman, is to conform to notarial officers and then provide these new procedures. Those new procedures that you'll find over, for example, on pages 21 through 23, providing for new types of processes for affirming documents when they're overseas, when and a variety of occasions, and having been a notary public for years, I've never run into any of these circumstances, but if you find one of these unique situations. It provides a solution. And for that reason, I'd ask you to adopt the whole bill. Stand for questions.
We're on the standing committee amendment, Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you. You're not Mr. Chairman. You're Mr. Chairman. I'm so sorry. I recognize that bald head from last year. So, perhaps the good senator could explain to us what a jurat is and what's the difference between a notary and a notary notarial act, and maybe if he could explain why we're repealing 32.1105D, which is an interstate provision between us and other states, and why he's doing that. And I know he can't do that, so we'll just go on, and we'll have to get those answers tomorrow. But I think we ought to get the standing committee done and get this bill out of here.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I urge you to adopt the standing committee.
The testimony we had in committee was that this language was archaic and unnecessary. It doesn't change the meaning because it means the county clerk anyhow, so let's get rid of it.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I do note that the words notarial act apply because there are other people besides notary that can notarize things. So that's why we use the term notarial act. And there is a provision that we've got to fix a little later on that has to do with a repealer that's about Wyoming notaries being able to do Montana documents that we caught up in the repealer. We're going to have to get that. But it's a really good amendment, and I think we ought to adopt it.
Question called for. All in favor of Senator Case's motion that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 150 be adopted, all say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Amendment is adopted. We're back on the bill. Further discussion on the bill. Question been called for. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it does so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 150, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Mr. President.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 70, do pass, amended. Senate File 146, do pass. Senate File 105, do pass, amended. Senate File 145, do pass, amended. And Senate File 150, do pass amended. Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Hines?
Mr. President, I move adoption.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The committee of the whole report has been adopted. Reports from standing committees.
February the 7th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 127, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Cole, Jennings, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Co-Chairman. February the 7th, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 176, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, Jennings, and Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I believe that clears the desk.
Mr. President, before I make the appropriate motion, members of the Senate, good work. Today was a great day. Did some heavy lifting. It's the end of Committee of the Whole for Senate files. And I just applaud you for your good work and your hard work. And we'll continue to do that work as we start working House bills on general file. And with that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 8th.
Any announcements? Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources. Tomorrow night, that'll be Tuesday night, the 8th, up in S-15. We'll take up House Bill 66, Water Development Projects Funding. House Bill 6, Packaging, Labeling, and Advertising of Honey Repeal. House Bill 156, Grand Teton National Park Transfer of State Lands.
Senator Cole?
Mr. President, your committee number 4, just an early reminder, we'll meet Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. over here in S-11 by the Johnson County Smoking Lounge. And and take up House Bill 13, Hathaway Success Curriculum, and House Bill 72, Engrossed Teacher Merit Pay.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, may I have the privilege of the floor, please?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Mr. President, there's a bumper sticker out there that says, I'm from Johnson County. I haven't liked anything from Cheyenne since 1892. I don't like the smoking lounge. It's really getting cold out there. But anyway, Mr. President, could I make a
you certainly can. Announcement? Thank you.
Mr. President, your Transportation Committee will meet in 10 minutes up in S-14 to take up House Bill 139, Wyoming Veterans Memorial Highway, and House Bill 177, Engrossed Vietnam and Veterans Welcome Home and Thank You Day.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Corporations Committee number 7 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room S-19 to take up House Bill 2, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Sunset, House Bill 4, Department of Insurance Background Checks, House Bill 9, Department of Insurance Licensure Revisions, House Bill 114, Engrossed Insurance Premiums, Failure to Pay. We're going to have lots of insurance in the morning, Mr. President.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President, your Committee number 1 Judiciary will meet on Wednesday, February the 9th at 8 a.m. in room S1 to consider the following bills. House Bill 40, Compensation for Persons Exonerated Based on DNA. House Bill 95, Involuntary Commitment Examiners. You may sign up if you, I don't know what that one's about yet. And House Bill 123, Circuit Court Surety Bonds Repeal.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, Committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow noon, 15 minutes after the noon recess. We'll take up House Bill 117, Engrossed Data Processing Services Center Tax Exemptions. House Bill 145, Engrossed Vehicle Registration Timing. If time permits, House Bill 146, Engrossed Vehicle Sales and Use Tax.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will meet at 9 a.m., not 8, 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, where we will take up House Joint Resolution Engrossed number 6, Private Property Protection.
Other announcements? Seeing none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion has carried. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 o'clock a.m. tomorrow, February the 8th. We are adjourned.